Test, test.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. And thanks for being here. We were just waxing nostalgia before getting started, but it's great to be back in the Board of Public Works and the virtual meeting. And just for those who are going to be testifying today, I just want to let you know that we are going to have a bond sale today, so at some point, possibly around 11 o'clock, we may be interrupted for an update on the status of the sale. The bond sale advances, and you know, we're all proud of the fact that Maryland has been able to receive the AAA bond rating from all of the three bond rating agencies, and it is a strong testament to the work of this board and my colleagues, what they've been doing. It was pointed out by the bond agencies about the fiscal stewardship of this board, as well as the, you know, working for on behalf of the taxpayers, and as well as the state's maintenance of significant reserves. These were all noted by the bond agencies in keeping us in the AAA status. As the state continues to, you know, come together with regard to addressing our coronavirus pandemic, we have been rolling out the vaccines, as was mentioned before. We are now up to, at least as far as first-time doses, 768,000, over 768,000 individuals have received at least their first dose of the vaccine. I believe we're now up to about 12% of the population, state population, which is really, in a sense, an undercount because we're only vaccinating those 18 and above, well, really 65 and above and the first responders. But in terms of the population right now, it's 18 and above. So we would be a higher percentage of that grouping. The governor announced yesterday that we will be opening another mass vaccination site at M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore. And more than 10,000 appointments have been made for that site, and it's expected in about by next week they'll be administering 2,000 doses per day at that location. And they also announced the fourth mass vaccination site for Charles County at the Blue Crab Stadium. I've never been there. I've driven by there in Charles County, and we're looking forward to that opening up. We're hearing a lot of positive news with regard to production of the vaccines. Moderna and Pfizer have announced recently that they're going to be increasing capacity. I believe they said they're going to be doubling their production. We're expecting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to come out very soon, which is a single-dose vaccine that can be kept in regular refrigerators for a period of time. So I feel very soon we will be able to provide vaccines to all those who seek it. And we're going to need to continue to encourage individuals to get the vaccine when it is available. You know, I think we, and I don't want to diminish this, but I think we're going to run into a situation where we are going to be encouraging people to get the vaccine. You know, I'm now going to sound like a cranky old man, but I am a little concerned that some of the younger people who have stereotypically have not been taking the virus as seriously as some of us have might start to see where our numbers are looking positive in terms of less people are becoming infected, less people are going into hospitals, there are less fatalities, that may not feel that it's that important that they get the vaccine, but it will be that important for them to get the vaccines as well, because viruses mutate, and so long as the virus is around and transmitting, there's a chance that it can mutate to something that is more resistant to the vaccines that we have and the vaccines that are coming out. So, you know, we have to continue to be diligent, and just because some of us have received the vaccine, that doesn't mean that we could just go hog wild and, you know, take our mask off. We still have to be very careful because it's still a lot of unknowns with regard to whether, even after a vaccine, whether you can transmit it and not know that you have the virus because you're not getting sick, you're asymptomatic. So that's one of the things that we have to point out to those who do get the vaccine, that you still have to be diligent, you know, give it some more time before we can go completely back to normal. And that means, you know, continuing to wear a mask, watch our hygiene, and our distance. To accommodate this expected increase in vaccines, the governor announced that a new statewide pre-registration system will be launched in the next week or so to take reservations for the state-run sites, the mass vaccination sites, in a way to get more shots into people's arms. And you know, we're encouraging people, you know, that want to get those shots to do so, not only to protect themselves, but to protect others. And with that said, I just, in the last couple of weeks, I've visited a couple of the community vaccine sites. And last week, I spoke to some of the healthcare providers from MedStar, who are running a community vaccination site at Leisure World in Montgomery County. And they spoke about how rewarding it was to be able to vaccinate these individuals who were excited about getting the vaccine and very thankful for receiving the vaccines. And it really was a big morale boost for them because they've been dealing with, for the last 10 months or so, they are on the front lines of seeing all the pain and all the anguish and all the challenges that were brought by the pandemic. And in this case, they are on the positive side of that equation. And, you know, they really stress how, you know, how good they feel when they're giving the vaccines, because everyone is excited. Everyone is saying thank you and very pleased. So, you know, it's a mental health boost for them, and sometimes we forget about those on the front line and what they're facing and what they're challenging. And, you know, and it's just generally the pandemic's impact on all of our mental health and well-being, and particularly for our vulnerable seniors as well as our children. And mentioning children, I do want to take the time to echo the importance of students returning to school, not only for the socialization aspects, which helps their mental health, but I am very concerned about the learning loss that a number of these kids are experiencing. We had challenges before with some kids falling behind, but it's even more challenging now. There are, you know, a number of the school systems have pointed out, you know, that their students are just suffering, you know, it's, for lack of a better word, with a lot of the virtual learning, and particularly when you get to the special needs kids. And so, you know, I applaud those school systems that are taking steps, excuse me, to bring the students back into the classroom or making plans to bring them back into the classroom. And the science is, you know, has told us that it's safe to reopen the schools. Right now, our positivity rate is now below 4%, which is below the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's standard, you know, in terms of low-risk transmission within schools. And we know many of the teachers are eager to get back into the classroom and provide the education that's needed for these students. And that's why we want to make sure that we did it in a safe way, and we've moved the educators to the front of the priority line to make sure that they can get the vaccines on a timely basis. But the Centers for Disease Control have said that, you know, that they don't necessarily need to get the vaccines to get back in the classroom, so long as it's done in a safe manner and the you know, hygiene and the protections are put in place. Through our Department of Education, you know, we've awarded some $781 million in additional funds to assist the schools and students with reopening the classes, assessing and addressing this learning loss issue, which I mentioned before, and providing targeted tutoring where that's going to help. You know, and through both that, they and the health department also provided additional monies for testing, COVID tests in the public as well as the non-public schools for, you know, in-person learning. And I know many of the counties are taking advantage of that. And the governor's invested, you know, federal funding to retrofit a number of the schools to address the ventilation concerns that folks have. And yesterday, the governor clarified that students, you know, are required to wear masks, you know, in the classrooms as well. So there's extensive guidance out there, and we think that it can be addressed. I think it's very important that these kids get back in school. Like I said, I'm really concerned about the learning loss and how we handle that. We know we've had situations where kids were pushed along, even in the pre-pandemic world, in terms of the next grade. And if we don't do that, and I know any parent and definitely any school kid who might be listening to that, if we don't get them back in school, they may have to be in school all summer. And I know the comptroller doesn't like that. Because, I mean, it's just, you just can't take that child who has missed a lot of this year and is just not really at, let's say, fifth grade level work and then send them to the sixth grade next year. It's just, it's a disservice to them, and it's going to be a disservice to our society. And then, as I mentioned before, just the socialization issue and the mental health issue of the kids, and particularly, you know, I'm aware of that, and we hear about that with our mental health commission, that it's not, and we started that commission pre-pandemic because we do have another crisis out there, and it's in the mental health community, and how we address individuals who have mental health challenges. And it's going to continue, after the virus subsides. And so, I mean, I can ramble on, particularly when we get to the mental health, concerns that I have. Not just for children, but a challenge that we've had in this country for a long time in terms of how we address that. But I am going to stop and turn it over to my colleagues for their comments. Treasurer Cox.
Governor, I just want to reiterate all that you have said. It is so important for people to be patient. In our area, people want to get the vaccination. I mean, there is no question about it, and it is very frustrating to be on lists for weeks and weeks and not know what is happening next. So I think the standing up of all these new sites is tremendously important. A personal note, my husband just got an email yesterday from Montgomery County. He's in that category that should be getting the vaccinations, that he will have an appointment. So that's not only is it exciting for him and for me, but for all our children and all the friends who have been nagging, and he's been saying, I'm on the list, it'll come up. He now can tell them all that, in fact, it did, or we assume it will, this afternoon.
Okay. Just make sure he doesn't forward that email to other people.
Right. Oh, no. The comptroller knows my husband. He follows every jot and tittle of the procedure that you follow. But the other thing I would add to your concern about the young people and others who don't think that they need to be vaccinated and are reading that more and more people are, so they think, okay, they'll do it. That's fine. We're going to have this herd immunity. The fact is the vaccination rates are erratic all over the state. So you don't know that your community has actually reached that level. And the virus is still out there. So I would say to these people, we all know, and nobody is invulnerable. And we owe it to ourselves, our families, and our community to help build up this immunity to this virus that's still out there. And we'll be out there. And talking about long-term issues, I can't let the day pass without saying that between the last meeting and this meeting, the United States of America, under the direction of President Biden, re-entered the Paris Accords. We are now in. We have been in at the state level. in Maryland and many other states, but now the whole country as a whole is in the accords and going to be working together, one hopes, to combat greenhouse gas and the terrible havoc that the greenhouse gases, the greenhouse gas emission is forcing on our country. But the other thing is that in this past week, your administration has issued its greenhouse gas reduction plan, the permanent plan, not the draft plan. We're only beginning to go over it now and to understand what's in it and what it will call upon all of our communities to do. But I think it's a very significant step forward. It will need changes. It will need support. It will probably need strengthening. But it's there now, and that's so important. I congratulate you, Secretary Grumbles, and everybody who's involved in it.
I saw, and I didn't read the article, but in one of the clips this morning, that there was a group calling for increased composting to address climate change, and I think they're looking at emissions from landfills. My family will tell you about composting for years. Fortunately, we have room in the backyard to compost our yard waste, but also kitchen waste. I've trudged down and done all the kitchen to food waste. Not me, though.
Yes. Well, that points out, though, that part of this plan
means
that every citizen in this state, every one of us, all the communities, as well as agencies of government and the private sector, are all going to have to be doing our parts, working together. And as someone else said, building back better. It was President Biden.
Yes. I'm not sure grammatically. All right. Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor, and good morning, Madam Treasurer. And I just want to note for the record that on Monday, our nation honored and remembered 500,000 Americans who have lost their lives due to COVID-19, and in particular, 7,617 Marylanders, friends and neighbors of ours, who have died. And I want to thank the administration, frankly, for I believe the flags are at half-mast today in recognition of that. Obviously, the citizens of our state and of the nation have suffered a tremendous amount of loss over the past year. And the resiliency that we're demonstrating is always positive, but as we continue on this path of resiliency, obviously, the glimmers of hope, whether they take the form of a vaccine or small business loan or a stimulus payment or a rent forbearance. I'd like to echo a comment made the day before yesterday by President Joe Biden, and for all of us to ponder, and I quote, "Remember those we lost and those who are left behind." And this will take a minute to read, because I thought this expression of support for people that are grieving their lost ones was just so authentic from Joe Biden. He said in his speech, "For those who have lost loved ones, this is what I know. They're never truly gone. They'll always be part of your heart. I know this as well, and it seems unbelievable, but I promise you, the day will come when the memory of the loved one you lost will bring a smile to your lip before a tear to your eye. It will come, I promise you. My prayer for you, though, is that this day will come sooner rather than later." And that's when you know you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. I find those words to be very comforting, regardless, frankly, of the party or office or whatever. And anyway, let me get off that subject, because my own father and mother, I was at least able to hold their hands when they passed away, and I was able to honor them with a funeral, and now it's like just totally weird, and my heart goes out to people.
Well, But Mr. Controller, you know, just that comment is so true with regard to what the president said. And I received a very similar comment from Governor Schaefer, when my dad passed. He said pretty much the same thing, that at some point you will be able to, your memory will bring a smile to your face. And that is so true. It takes time. And there'll be times when it brings a tear, even years later, but there are times you know, someone says something or you find yourself saying what your parents said. You know, we become our parents. And then you then it brings a smile and you say, oh, yeah, that's what my dad said.
Yeah.
I become my father.
My mother used to say, gee, willikers. So I'm trying not to say that. That's a little old-fashioned for me. But yeah. Thank you for that. It's bad.
Could I just jump on what you said and urge people? You can go to YouTube or look at to watch and listen to President Biden's the ceremony. It was a very brief ceremony, but it was very heartrending and really the brought home what we have suffered significantly, and yes, left with a note of hope. Really urgent. Yeah.
On another note, thank you, Madam Treasurer and Lieutenant Governor. I'm pleased to report that 98% of the stimulus payments to eligible Marylanders in the Relief Act have been processed and are out of our office. More than 266,000 electronic payments and 148,000 mail checks, accounting for $175 million in total relief payments, have been disbursed. None of this would have been possible without the diligent planning and Herculean work of the 1,100 dedicated members of the Comptroller's Agency. They all continue to work around the clock to ensure that struggling Marylanders and small businesses receive the relief they're entitled to and access to the resources to address their inquiries. For example, over 450,000 visits have been made to the online Relief Act stimulus portal that we set up. I lay awake at night dreaming that it had frozen up and crashed. Fortunately, it hasn't. We had a combined 5,100 inquiries that have received by social media and mail and answered. We're fielded over, this is just for the relief plan, over 14,000 phone calls with an average wait time of 57 seconds before taxpayers are connected with a live, friendly, professional member of my staff. But the work hasn't stopped then. We remain committed to getting those payments to the more than 6,000 eligible recipients, or the remaining 2%, who do not have a verified address with the U.S. Postal Service or a bank account that's verified. As those Marylanders contact our office to verify their Maryland residency, we will process their payments with the same speed and efficiency as we did with the 98% of payments last week. Furthermore, beginning next week and throughout the next several months in partnership with the state's Department of Labor, we will begin to process and disperse the $1,000 unemployment grants to eligible Marylanders under the Relief Act. All the while, we have been conducting this and the normal day-to-day business of tax administration during our busiest time of the year. In the last week, we have processed 565,616 refund requests and checks during the normal tax season, which opened on February 12th, and just very pleased that the staff is able to show that anybody who's lost their trust in state government or in government generally, I guess, can look to the Comptroller's Office for leadership, customer service, and the kind of results that Marylanders deserve. And lastly, Lieutenant Governor, I appreciate that Governor Hogan, God bless him, is testifying before the United States Senate on all these topics about investing in transportation to address climate change and improve equity. I would just note for the record that this is the second consecutive BPW meeting that he's missed, and given all the challenges we're facing here at home, I just hope that is not becoming a habit. Much as I appreciate my dear friend Boyd Rutherford, I hope that the governor will return to the board at whenever he thinks it's appropriate. Thank you.
I think our cabinet secretaries would probably appreciate the governor coming back because I asked a lot more questions than the guys. I'm a lot more, when it comes to the Board of Public Works, a lot more detailed and willing to hold our own officials accountable. And I have questions today on a number of the matters that were decided at the department level, but I think need to have further scrutiny. So with that, John, Secretary's agenda.
Morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. There are 10 items on the Secretary's agenda and 15 reports of emergency procurements. Item 813 has been withdrawn at the request of the department. Item 4 has been revised, and item 3 is the bond sale item you mentioned earlier, Governor. Happy to assist with taking any questions.
The one that was withdrawn?
Okay. I want to bring up Secretary Holt with regard to item 6.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, and Lieutenant Governor, it's great to see you.
Good to see you.
This item is the awards under the Baltimore Regional Neighborhood Initiative, Bernie, which is a wonderful program. My concern is that when I go through the awards, and particularly as it relates to Baltimore City, a number of the awards are going to what I would call the usual suspects, the same developers that are doing these projects seem to be getting these awards. And so I'm just concerned about what kind of education process and outreach we're doing for, you know, the newer developers, the smaller projects, the smaller nonprofits, because a number of the projects, when you look further in, and it's not in the item, but, you know, I know about some of these projects that it's folks that have been around for a long time. They may have gotten the property from the city for, you know, pennies on the dollar, and then they turn around and they get hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars from the state to develop the property, and they haven't put any or very little equity other than the property that they got for a pittance as their equity. I'm not stopping or saying, no, we shouldn't do it, and the projects are good, and some of them I've been to, you know, home building, Henderson Crossing, and at EBDI, I'm very familiar with that, the pump house, I'm just pointing out, even Mary Harbin, and we've talked about Mary Harbin, and there's a lot of money that went in, that was property that was rebuilt after the Freddie Gray riots. I lived in Los Angeles during Rodney King, so they started from that. That the state rebuilt that property. And it's just, I think that it gets to, there are some folks who know the process and they know how to fill out the forms. They may even have some professional help. And so they're able to get this, you know, the assistance, and there are others out there that, you know, kind of look and say, why is it that this guy, you know, this gal always get this assistance for their projects, and, you know, we come in with a project and we're asking for a fraction of the amount and we don't get it. So it's really more of a outreach and education, because at some point these individuals have learned the process themselves. And so how can we make sure that there are opportunities for others and not just the major players or the usual suspects, as I've just said?
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. I think you make very good points. I think a couple of things to understand. Firstly, Bernie requires that there be community development organizations that become approved through an application process. So we'll have sort of two tiers established here. The first tier is a base of applicants, let's say 20-plus organizations in the Baltimore area that are proven, well-established, experienced, and have the financial capacity to carry out very substantial redevelopment initiatives. Those organizations, however, receive sub-applicant interest and put an application to us on behalf of these sub-applicants. So what happens is the money that goes into, let's say, this limited group of Bernie-approved community development organizations, they push that money down into the grassroots by supporting smaller developers that have come to them and sort of piggybacked on their application. The pump house is a good example. Money that's going to that community development organization is actually being pushed down to small developers who are coming in and acquiring and then rehabbing one or two scattered site units. So if you would suggest to us that we ought to carve some money aside for direct applicants from smaller sort of non-approved organizations, we can certainly do that, but it creates a fairly significant processing burden, not just our department, but the interagencies that are involved in approving all of these applications. Now, we have, I think, on the call today, Carol Gilbert and Kevin Baines, who are the architects of Bernie, and they're complying with state statute, which has really described how Bernie has to be structured. And that requirement means that we have to establish the Bernie-approved organization process first. So if you'd like, I can have Carol and or Kevin maybe explain a little bit further.
I don't need that. And, you know, it's in a sense, I wasn't asking for any cutout or, you know, set aside. It's almost like a straw man. What I'm saying is, and maybe it's at that Bernie approved, and we can talk about it later, you know, and maybe this isn't the place that Bernie approved group of 20 or more that, you know, like in the case of the Perkins Homes, that's not a small developer that's doing that. That's Michael Beatty and his group. I mean, he's a big time developer. Bill Strieber and Ann Riegel, they're not, you know, small. They've been around for a long time and have been doing major work. And I understand that, you know, when I was a salesperson years ago, I sold IT services, and it was, you know, there was kind of a joke. I didn't work for IBM, but it was easy for a person to say, you know, the IT person, they used to call them data processing manager, to say, if the system blew up, to say, well, I bought IBM. And people would say, okay, just get it fixed. But if you bought non-IBM, it was like, why didn't you buy IBM? So it's always easy to go to the folks who have been doing it for a long time. And so maybe it gets back to this pre-authorization aspect of how we do this. But I'm not going to belabor it. I just wanted to make the point that I am concerned that the same folks that know the system are getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in one project alone. It's about $1 million or $1.7 million in Bernie money. And there are other projects that just don't seem to have that ability to break through the process. So, you know, we can talk further in terms of what kind of outreach, because these folks learn somewhere along the line how to do it. So there need to be others that have the ability to learn how to do it. And maybe it's not for government to do. Maybe it's other contractors or other, you know, consultants. And they have the wherewithal themselves to hire these consultants. So.
I think you make a very good point, and I think our response should be to sort of improve the messaging and the communication out into the Baltimore community to inform people that if they want to be receiving Bernie money, they have to come forward and become a Bernie-approved applicant. And
I get the complaints. I'm getting the concerns and complaints. And like I said, I know these developers from, you know, my time at DGS and others, that they're not small-time players.
No.
It's really working with the city, you know, in terms of what the city does and how they, you know, get involved in projects. And so I'm not going to leave it there.
Okay.
Mr. Secretary, I just wanted to make sure I brought that up.
We'll go ahead and broaden the net.
Okay. Well, thank you. I know you will.
Governor, before we leave that item, could I just ask, you've been great, Mr. Secretary, about in your departmental items, spelling out how you are combating climate change and being energy efficient. Is that part of these projects as well?
Well, I think a lot of the renovation and construction projects, especially the large ones, will follow green standards and we'll try to renovate, whether they're rental assistance demonstrations, very large renovations of public housing that have gone into private hands. All those are designed to be compliant with green standards. If you get down to a small, like the Dundalk Renaissance Corporate, which might have two or three or four scattered sites, just row houses that they've acquired to rehab, that's probably not up to the green standard. But we do require, high-quality construction. We monitor the construction, and we're quite confident that all of the weatherization and energy efficiency standards that we expect are implemented in the work.
I just hope to do that with intentionality and make sure that the developers and the people who are working on each project understand the importance of making these buildings and these projects sustainable into the future.
Absolutely.
I would think the Perkins Homes project, you know, that's multi-family, I would think that they
absolutely
have these sustainability concerns in there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And there are small things that could be done with just row houses, even if it's not, you know, an instant program, just the weatherization, but also, you know, some minor green roof, not entire, because you have to have a structure, but, you know, some planters that reduce the amount of water that is going to flow down into the streets that can be captured with, you know, sedums and some other smaller plants that can be placed on the roof of a building. So.
Well, and take a look at the greenhouse gas plan that your administration, Mr. Secretary, is putting forth, because it calls for a transition to electric buildings when you're talking about major renovation and new buildings in the very, very near future.
Absolutely. And we were a part of the information process that formed the recommendation to the governor through the Maryland Department of the Environment and Ben Grumbles. He and I interacted on that. Our people provided recommendations. So we were incorporated in that, and we're required to, you know, follow the highest standards, no question.
Okay, thank you. I do want to I'm just going to mention item 8. And just from the standpoint that I like to mention the parks, and Swallow Falls is a park that I think all of you should go to if you haven't been there. Well, thank you, Mr. Secretary. But, you know, Swallow Falls is a wonderful park. It's a wonderful waterfall. And this time of the year, when the waterfall freezes, it's cold to get up there and you've got to trudge through the snow. It is really a sight to behold as well, to see the frozen waterfall. And just as a point of history, in 1921, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and Harvey Firestone actually camped out at Swallow Falls. I mean, in a tent, the three of these gentlemen, Could you imagine three titans of industry today literally sleeping in a tent? I guess it would be Zuckerberg from Facebook and Bezos from Amazon and somebody else, another titan of industry, sleeping in a tent. I think they'd have it catered, and it'd be an RV, something, or some special tent. But they literally camped out there in 1921. So I just wanted to point that out. Okay.
I have a question, Lieutenant Governor, on the item that was withdrawn, since it was on the agenda. I took a look at it. And it just reminded me, this is, even though it's been withdrawn, it's Secretary Sports, but it's A-13 that has been withdrawn. But I'd like to take advantage of the fact it was on the agenda to ask the Secretary or Executive Director Sports from the Transit Association. I believe it's a $43.3 million emergency contract award to Wagman Heavy Civil to install the all-electronic collection and automatic lane control system at the Bay Bridge, something that is obviously very, very helpful to the traffic congestion. And that's an issue I raised in fall of 2019. And I think Executive Director Ports and Secretary Slater's predecessor responded with, I guess, this single bid or single allocation, whatever you call it, a contract. So, A, I want to salute Executive Director Ports for and commend you and your team to in the way in which you have expedited, in accordance, obviously, with Governor Hogan's directives, and you're addressing the concerns that are going to, I think, invest in the safety and well-being of the Bay Bridges travelers and workers, and it's going to really relieve the congestion there. I understand it's a three-year effort. I guess what I'd like to hear from the Maryland Transportation Authority is you're going to, in the future, make every effort to solicit and receive competitive procurements when you have something like a $43 million contract, and ultimately ensure, I hope, that the taxpayers are getting the best possible deal through competitive procurements, not the situation we're facing right now.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Greg Slater, Maryland Department of Transportation Secretary. We also have Executive Director Jim Ports on here as well. Your point is well taken. I think the nature of this particular effort, when we went to all-electronic tolling, it really created two particular issues that we needed to make sure were addressed quickly from a safety perspective. First is just being able to get that gate system in place so that, you know, our folks are not out there when high-speed traffic is going through where those toll entries used to be, putting out cones and those types of things. So one, kind of creating a safer environment for them. But two, creating this gate system where we can transfer back and forth from one direction to the other gives us greater flexibility to manage the congestion in both directions on that bridge. It just created a number of safety challenges for us that we wanted to make sure we addressed very quickly. Let me see if Executive Director Ports wants to add anything as well.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, good morning. And for the record, my name is Jim Ports, Executive Director for Maryland Transportation Authority. And Mr. Comptroller, I start off with G. Willikers. And I hope that helps you remember your mother. But as you recall, as you mentioned and you recall, we had the redecking project, which was slated to last two seasons. And I was asked to accelerate that project, working with Governor Hogan and yourself, as well as the treasurer, who all gave us a directive back in 2019 to expedite these projects when it comes to the Bay Bridge. Some of it based on safety, like Secretary Greg Slater just said, including, by the way, all the traffic that goes into the communities and blocks up those roads for their safety and emergency management equipment. And we've gotten letters of support from both the Bragg and Queen Anne's County, as well as information from Anne Arundel County, suggesting that we try to accelerate projects that include safety. So, as you know, we were able to accelerate that project through some emergency orders, and when we got that completed in 1 year, it was a successful project. And then shortly after that, Governor Hogan directed us to go to all electronic tolling. Part of that was COVID-related, and part of it was he wanted to increase the amount of flow of traffic on that bridge. And so he asked us to get that done as quickly as possible. What our team thought was impossible, but it ended up being very possible. We thought we were going to get completed in July. We accelerated some of those timelines on that procurement, and we completed that one in April 1st. So we've got some successes. Now that brings us to this contract. And as you may know, as I know you do know, we have a project going on the westbound bridge currently, and that's a gate system. And that's to help, as Secretary Slater said, the fact that we don't have to put cones out there and take the time to do that, which increases the amount of traffic and backups, as well as the gate system will help protect our employees. Because now with AET, they are going at highway speeds, as Secretary Slater said, and it does put our employees at a greater risk. And so since we already had the westbound project going on, we thought it'd be extremely important to have both bridges work consistently with each other. And so this project was originally slated for completion around 2023. As you do know, we have some work on the eastbound bridge that's going to be coming up. You're familiar with the redecking. Well, this is going to be replacing some of that concrete. And as you know, Governor Hogan, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, both believe in continuity of government, and we felt it was going to be very important also for the safety of this project when we do the redecking on the eastbound bridge to have that traffic flow as easily and safely as possible. And quite frankly, it will help the next administration with that project as far as working it smoothly with the bridge. And what we also know, and Greg Slater knows this very well, being from administrator from SHA, is when you put cones and barrels out, people get very confused, and we have people hit them all the time. And so with the gate system, it increases the amount of safety, and safety is imperative on that bridge. So for all those reasons, we did the emergency order. We do try to, as you mentioned, Mr. Comptroller, try to bid these out. We did have, as I mentioned, the other project on the westbound bridge, so we had something to go by, and this was fairly close to our estimate, our engineer's estimate, so we felt good about moving this project forward for all those reasons we mentioned.
Gene Willikers, Mr. Executive. I was just patting you on the back and giving you some praise, but I appreciate what you said. Just make sure in the future we're not giving any blank checks or, sweetheart deals that end up, unfortunately sometimes not necessarily with you, but with you know what happens when you don't have open competition.
Sure.
So to the extent, A, kudos for the job you're doing. B, try to get competition down the road. And I know, Jim, that you and I served with Treasurer Kopp in the legislature, and nobody ever gave us credit for anything, but I've given you credit for this. Good job.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Kopp. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Governor, I had another question on, unless...
Well, I know we have Lisa Witness on Emergency 2, but if you want to go with your other question...
Well, go ahead. I'm happy to follow you.
Emergency Report A2 is a report from the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. I believe we have Secretary Green available to address the emergency report.
I guess you can take A2 and 3 together.
Also, okay. Report from the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services.
Yeah.
Very good. Good morning, the Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. My name is Robert Greener, Secretary of the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. Just for the record, also joining me today can assist us is our Procurement Director, Anna Lansall, Deputy Secretary of Administration, Chris McCauley, and the Assistant Attorney General for the Department, Stu Nathan. This is emergency, an emergency modification number 2 to the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services contract providing statewide medical care and utilization services for approximately 20,000 inmates across our system. As a matter of history, at the June 13, 2020 Board of Public Works meeting, Secretary's agenda item A14 was not accepted, subsequently remanded back to the department with the direction to terminate that emergency contract and provide a new modification. We bring before you today this modification with the second and
I don't think it's just him.
Yeah, I can hear you, Madam Treasurer. I couldn't hear the Lieutenant Governor.
Right.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. There was something with the Secretary's audio. Partially, I hear, but...
Underwater.
Yeah. Now I don't hear you at all.
I will try on another device.
There we go. No, we have...
You're there. Yeah.
Does it sound like I'm a bit in and out for the board?
Yeah, it may be there was some interference of some sort.
All right. Very, very good. My apologies. I don't want that to occur. This is a modification. If I need to repeat, it's a modification.
No, you shouldn't need to repeat that. And you also introduced the individuals who are with you. I just want to say that we had a Mr. Gariano who wants to speak on behalf of a different vendor. And he has spoken before. Quite frankly, it's a little, and I know we didn't object to these things before, but it's a little odd for someone to come in to speak for the predecessor who lost the contract in a competitive bid and, I guess they exhausted their remedies at the time and are still complaining and are coming in after the fact. But I will let Mr. Barrianos state his case.
I have a few questions. Okay.
No, go ahead. There's a few questions now, and then we'll have the witness speak.
Happy to hear. Always happy to hear from Mr. Barriano.
Should I proceed, Governor?
Yes, I think Council is
ready. Good morning, Governor, and Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Bruce Barriano, and I'm here on behalf of Wexford Health. And I fully respect and appreciate your opening comments, Governor. I'm here because... really want to make sure that the taxpayers' money is not being wasted and utilized inappropriately in this contract. I've sent you all some significant information. I'm not going to repeat it all. You all know the history of this matter. It was $50 million underbid. I told you then, I tell you now, they can't do the contract for that. It's very relevant to the vendor is owned by a company that only handles bottom feeder companies. And Corizon's been trying since they had the contract to get more money out of the state than what they bid it for. They tried 4 times and were told no, and they're using COVID now Everyone's concerned about COVID. I'm not denying that at all, but the truth of the matter is that Verizon's getting far more money than they should be, and it's taxpayers' money that's being wasted. And I don't know why it took 7.5 months. To me, it's just astonishing. But I think the colloquy you all had was very clear and very correct, and that was pay the expenses for COVID-related matters, submit auditable receipts, and you'll be paid. And they didn't do it for 7.5 months. Now they come in with a whole new proposal, which has a cap to it, which is X number of dollars a month. And I think they're really ignoring what the board, 3-0, told them to do. And it's very simple. It's what all other providers, my client as well, is doing in other jurisdictions. And the approach being presented here today is really a further waste of money. By their own accord, it is costing them about $1.1-2 million a month in COVID expenses. I think that's very high, but it's $1.1-2 million. They already got $11.2 million, and if you take that, really, Verizon owes the state $4 million that they got that they didn't use for COVID expenses during the time period before the contract was terminated. And that's money of the states. It's money that could be used elsewhere. It's taxpayers' money that went to a company that doesn't deserve it because they bid it at a certain price. In terms of now, my ask is that you don't need a $2 million cap each year. You don't need a not-to-exceed cap. Just tell the department to do what 7.5 months they were told to by the board, and that is submit your expenses, pay your COVID expenses, submit your bills, and we'll have them audited, and if they're valid and legitimate, they'll be paid, whatever the amount is. There's no need for a cap. God forbid it might get higher at one point in time. But the department is not doing that. And I just urge the board, in conclusion, to stick to what you said 7.5 months ago. And it was very clear, it was very simple, and didn't take 7.5 months to figure out. And that is, if there are COVID expenses that Verizon has, pay them, because we have to take care of the inmates and the guards. No question about that. Then submit them. They're audited, as I know the treasurer was very big on that, and rightfully so. And if they're legitimate, they'll be paid. It doesn't take 7.5 months to do that. And here you get a big bill now, and you're asked, well, it's going to be about $2 million a month, and we need $24 million. Then it's just not the way to proceed. It's not a proper use and expenditure of taxpayers' money. And I would urge you to just tell the department to go back and do what they were asked to do 7.5 months ago. Thank you very much. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Question of Mr. Barayanna. Mr. Barayanna, you mentioned your client who had this contract granted before.
Yes.
What do they do around the rest of the country, or what is the procedure for most of your peer companies like Wexford concerning COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, Mr. Comptroller, thank you for the question. Ever since it started, they're in like states of Illinois, Indiana, West Virginia, Alabama, New Mexico, other states as well. And from the beginning, they obviously made extra expenditures for COVID-related matters. They submitted to those states their invoices. They were verified, they were found to be legitimate, and they were paid. And it was done immediately, simply, and without any bureaucracy or waiting 7.5 months. And they have found, with these states and others that have comparable sizes of populations of prisoners, that their additional expenses have been about $300,000 to $500,000 more a month. A month. And they have made the expenses. They've been reimbursed, and it's been a very simple, easy matter. And I'm not saying don't pay anything. I'm just saying let's look at the taxpayers' money, because all this money could go to other important things during this COVID economic crisis. Thank you.
Secretary Green to explain the process that they've gone through. But let me just, one thing with regard to a not-to-exceed limit. Under COMAR, you have to specify an amount of money that you expect to expend over a period of time for an emergency procurement. So it's we're not able to just say there's, you know, an unlimited, it's going to be an emergency, and we don't know what that number is going to be until after we receive. So that's why they go with the not-to-exceed number. But I can turn it over to Secretary Green in terms of what steps have been taken in response to the Board of Public Works action a number of months ago.
Thank you, Governor Rutherford. In terms of what we present today, we believe we have followed the direction of the Board of Public Works to a T. And I would ask that our Assistant Attorney General, Mr. Stu Nathan, who was intimately involved in these negotiations, please speak to that effort.
Yes. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Stuart Nathan, Principal Counsel for the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. And I would begin by saying that the modification does exactly what the board instructed the department to do. And I'll quote, "The contractor shall submit auditable invoices for all allowable costs caused by, related to, or arising from the COVID-19 pandemic." Exactly what the board instructed in June 17th. And just to go back for a moment to remind everyone, at the June 17th meeting, Mr. Gottram said the motion on the table is to rework the emergency modification that was entered into and change it from a fixed cost model to an auditable reimbursement model. That's correct. Controller Francho answered yes. That's exactly what the department has done. It's totally consistent with the statute, regulation, and DPW advisory on emergency procurements. And I don't want to belabor the legal explanation, but state finance and procurement, section 13108, that covers emergency procurements, specifically gives the head of a department and its procurement officer the authority to make an emergency procurement to mitigate or avoid serious damage to public health, safety, or welfare, and says that after awarding the contract, it shall submit to the BPW a written report giving justification, which is exactly what's been done. COMAR 2105-0601 and 02 just basically reiterate the same thing, that an emergency procurement shall be submitted, shall be prepared by the department, and shall be submitted as an action agenda item to the BPW within 45 days of contract modification. That's also been done. And the COMAR and the BPW advisory 2009-2 says when an agency must modify an existing contract on an emergency basis, the modification may be treated as an emergency procurement and reported to the board. And that's precisely what the department has done, submitting this emergency modification. And to make sure that I wasn't missing anything as far as the legal analysis, I've consulted with the head of the Attorney General's Contract Litigation Unit and the former deputy chief of that unit, who now works as counsel to the treasurer, to make sure that we were on firm footing by submitting this emergency procurement, and they both have assured me that we are, in fact, on firm footing, and this is an appropriate way to submit an emergency procurement. And finally, just let me end with some insight, just to talk a little bit about the work that's been done by our collaborators on treating the COVID pandemic. I'm familiar with the litigation that's been brought against the department as a result of COVID. And in cooperation with our partners, Department of Health, Department of General Services, and our private and our contractors, most notably Corizon, we've received approximately 20 to 25 cases brought by inmates or inmate families concerning COVID conditions in our prisons. And so far, Let me assure you, we have been successful in every single one of these cases where a decision has been rendered, that the care has been appropriate and the department has not been indifferent to these serious medical needs. So just we, in summary, we believe that we have fulfilled all the requirements from the board from the June 17th meeting, and it's appropriate for the emergency report, we believe, to be accepted by the board at this time. Thank you.
Members, I think the work of the board up and informed by the treasurer's office that the results of the bond sale are ready to be announced.
Let me just get my question in, and you can answer. You can think about it while we're getting the results. Why did it take 8 months to get back to us? This seems to be a fairly simple item. Why did it take 8 months? Well, let's, Governor, I'll defer to you as far as the bond sale.
Okay, we'll go to the bond sale, and they can respond after the bond sale.
Great. Thank you, Secretary Gonsar, members of the board. So we did sell some bonds today. We got it done this morning. We sold $425,000.
Chris, could you introduce yourself, please?
Certainly. Sorry. My name is Christian Lund. I'm the Director of Debt Management for the State Treasurer's Office. Thank you, Treasurer. We sold $425 million tax-exempt new money in two tranches and an additional $50 million in taxable new money. We got a great result, even though rates did move away from us just a little bit over the last week and a half or so. I just want to show you this slide really quickly to put some things in context. So this just shows municipal bond rates from 2018 through the present. The orange lines represent our past GO sales. Without getting into the weeds, you can just see in 2018, rates were a little higher. They declined through 2019, cratered in 2020. This period of volatility is obviously last spring during the pandemic, a lot of at the outset of the pandemic when there was a lot of fear and uncertainty in the financial markets. And then once things settled down, we got left in this incredibly low rate interest environment. And just to show you some even longer period context, here are rates since the beginning of the millennium, and just look at where we were in the 2000s and the 2010s, and now look at where we are now. We always thought of the 2010s as being this really low interest rate environment, and we are just far below where we were just a few years ago. So that is sort of the environment that we're issuing these bonds in. We got a really great result. We're going to continue to get really low interest rates for at least a little while longer. We did, if you look at this, you can see that we did lose a little bit just in the last week and a half. Treasury rates have been sort of steadily increasing since the beginning of the year, and unfortunately the muni market decided to catch up to treasuries all in the last couple of weeks here. So this result isn't as good as it would have been a couple of weeks ago, but still, as you just saw, really, really fantastic time to issue bonds and make capital investments in all the things that we know Maryland needs to do. Okay, so unless there are any questions on that, I will just show you the results themselves and ask for your approval. And let's see. Trying to get them up there, I apologize.
Nice color.
Yeah, just a blank screen, huh? Okay, here we go. Sorry about that. All right, so for this 2021 First Series A bonds, I'll make this bigger. We had a lot of interest this morning, so we had six bidders. Bank of America was the low bidder with a TIC of 0.922138. And we got a premium of about $61 million on this bidding group. For bidding group two, we got four bidders. Bank of America was again the low bidder with a TIC of 2.026869. And we got a premium of about $74 million on this tranche of bonds. And finally, For the taxable series, we had 8 bidders. Now, this is a little bit of a smaller, tranche of money, so we had more interest in it. Some of the smaller players could get involved. And we did see Wells Fargo come in with a low bid on this with a TIC of 486804.486804. And because it's taxable, the convention is that there's no bond premium included on this one. So with that...
What was the term of the taxables?
The taxable was only just the first 2 years. So we always structure our bonds to pay down the taxable bonds first because they are a little bit more expensive than our tax-exempt bonds. So these only go out through 2025, and that's the reason for that very low CIC compared to the other two tranches.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. Well, that's very interesting.
Yes. So, again, really great result for us, and we're very pleased with how this sale turned out.
Congratulations to everybody. That means we will be able to build our schools and state facilities at a very low interest rate, albeit not as low as it would have been a week ago.
That's right.
Governor, I move that the board adopt the resolutions before us, going back to the item in this agenda concerning the state and local facilities loan of the 2021 first series. I'm reading a script, you can tell. In particular, I move that the board ratify and approve the preliminary official statement dated February 17, 2021, the summary notice of sale for the 2021 first series bonds published in the Bond Buyer on February 12, 2021, and the resolutions adopted by the board on February 10, 2021 with respect to the bonds. Is there a second?
Second.
And could I ask for a vote on that motion?
Yes. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
I think it's 3-0. Thank you very much. Madam Treasurer,
there's more to come. Thank you. There's a great deal more to come.
Well, thank you.
It's still coming. I move that Bank of America Merrill Lynch be declared the successful bidder for Group 1 of the First Series A tax-exempt bonds in the aggregate principal amount of $207,460,000, subject to resizing as provided in the official notice of sale, with a net premium of $60,918,293.59, and a true interest cost of 0.922138%. And I further move that the first group of the first Series A bonds be issued in the amounts of maturities and at the interest rates and prices set forth in the successful bid for the bonds. Is there a second?
Second.
Could I ask for a vote on the...
All in favor?
Aye.
I think we have 3-0 here.
All right, we have a couple more. I move that America Merrill Lynch be declared the successful bidder for Group 2 of the First Series A tax-exempt bonds in the aggregate principal amount of $217,540,000, subject to resizing as provided in the official notice of sale, with a net premium of $73,850,580.05, and a true interest cost of 2.026869%. And I further move that the second group of the first Series A bonds be issued in the amounts of maturities and at the interest rates and prices set forth in the successful bid for the bonds. Ask for a second and a vote on the bidding group 2 first Series A motions.
Second.
I think we have all in favor.
One more. Actually, two more. I move that Wells Fargo Bank National Association be declared the successful bidder for the first Series B taxable bonds in the aggregate principal amount of $50 million, these are the taxable bonds, subject to resizing as provided in the official notice of sale, with a true interest cost of 0.486804%. And I further move that the first Series B bonds be issued in the amounts and maturities and at the interest rates and prices set forth in the successful bid for the bonds. Ask for second and a vote on the first series B bonds.
Second.
Are you all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And finally, I move that the board authorize and approve the issuance of the final official statement for the bonds.
Second. Okay, we're all folks in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
The deed is done, Governor and Comptroller. Thank everybody associated with it.
Yes, well, thank you,
congratulations,
department, for their excellent work. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Christian.
Okay. Back to items 2 and 3. The comptroller had a question for Secretary Green with regard to the timing of getting the invoices and process.
Yes, and once again, Assistant Attorney General Stu Nathan will speak to his negotiation processes.
Again, it's Stuart Nathan, Principal Counsel. I was the primary negotiator along with Deputy Secretary McCauley in formulating this emergency modification. It took much longer than I originally anticipated, but that was due to our trying very hard to make sure that we were totally in compliance with what the board instructed on June 17th. Frankly, there were some hiccups along the way in making sure that we were, totally compliant with the board's language. There was some negotiation back and forth on that to make sure that we met your requirements. And frankly, that took longer than we thought. But we think now that we have, as I've indicated in the language in the modification, been totally faithful to what the board instructed us to do on June 17th.
Well, Matt, I could be corrected by the treasurer, but what we asked you to do is pretty simple, and it seems as if, this could have been done within a week based on our clarity and, getting a figure. All we were looking for was the modification so that whatever expenses are paid have some basis in fact, and that you then pay it. 8 months later, you come back and say, well, that's what we're doing. And I understand what the Lieutenant Governor was saying about the not to exceed, but you were paying $6.7 million, which averages to $1.12 million. How long does it take to just say, yep, the board was pretty specific, the treasurer was very, very precise, and why don't we just do it? Sure, it sounds like there was something else going on in addition to our request.
If I may, Mr. Comptroller, in response to your question, this is a very complex medical contract and a system. We are part of and parcel to working with MDH hospitals, responding to COVID and where we are today. I would say to compare us to any other state is not appropriate. I do absolutely stay 100% connected to this issue with our colleagues around the state. But as evidence of what we have done from day one to now, this is a journey of complete evolution. Being responsive at every turn to the CDC guidance, the guidance of MDH, and making sure that the best in healthcare practices not only existed in our communities, but were brought inside our walls. As evidence, almost 54,000 tests conducted across our system, and that includes serial testing. That includes asymptomatic testing, not symptomatic testing. All of that is a matter of medical practice. It's a matter of protocol. It's a matter of how we move. But if I may, I understand the time frame that it took, and I wish we could have brought this to you sooner. But also, in complete respect to the board, we delayed payment of this modification, and have not yet, because we wanted to bring this back before the board to assure that we had done as you directed us to do. And hopefully a bit of that explanation helps in terms of a continuing evolving medical system and a process for us as we adjusted every new practice and every best practice in COVID mitigation.
Okay, well, I'll let the treasurer handle that because she kind of led the charge on it. I just find it to be not particularly persuasive because all we asked for were receipts and payments. That's an audit and has some kind of an audit on top of it. We weren't obviously getting in your way as far as providing or they providing health care to prisoners. But I did have a question about the $100,000 per month apparently we're paying for administrative labor for additional invoicing and tracking to Corizon. I mean, how did you arrive at that amount? And
very good.
Why are we paying for that, for, you know, the invoicing of expenses that are being made to us? It sounds just odd.
My apologies for interrupting, Mr. Comptroller. Assistant Attorney Nathan, Attorney General Nathan.
Yes, it's consistent with COMAR provisions. It's entirely acceptable to include certain indirect costs in a contract of this nature. When the first modification was terminated at the direction of the board and the decision was made to go to an audible reimbursement model, that meant that there were going to be additional costs incurred by Corizon, and perhaps they can explain even better than I, but additional costs for auditing, preparing invoices, doing the tracking, making sure that they were auditable invoices, all of which were additional indirect costs that, again, are typical of this type of a contract. And in this case, even at a $1 million mark, which is less than a monthly expenditure, it's 10%, which, again, is entirely consistent with what we see across the field in these types of contracts. So it's
an extraordinarily inadequate response. I mean, really. This company is not set up to send us invoices for payment. We have to pay them an additional $100,000 a month. Who negotiated that?
If I may, Mr. Comptroller, in respect to your decision, the conversion from the original contract as approved in 2018, which was a flat rate contract, and then conversion to this reimbursable and invoice model, I just want to note that that was another complication in the process.
I'll defer to the treasurer.
No, I don't have the invoices and audits before me, but I assume what you're saying, Mr. Secretary, is that you've changed the method, albeit there's a cap because of the law, and that you have the appropriate receipts now to justify to the federal government our reimbursement for all of these expenses?
We do, and Deputy Secretary of Administration Chris McCauley, you want to respond to the invoices that you have before you?
Good afternoon.
I don't require all the invoices. I have no intention of looking at all the invoices. I just want to know that they're there.
Just wanted to give you the assurances from his office that we have those, of what we have available to us. Mr. McCauley?
Good morning, members of the board.
I have all the invoices, Madam Treasurer. Yes. But I want to make sure we get them all.
It's a summary, I assume. Yeah.
Yeah, no, we have many, many pages. I'm happy to share them with you. And but I do want to make sure that we're going to get the invoices from January of this year through June when it happens in a timely manner, no later than September. Can you commit to that, Mr. Secretary?
January of the coming year? Or
now. Right now. We're in February now. January, February, March, April, May, and June. You'll get those invoices to the board before September.
Absolutely, Mr. Comptroller. We'll get those invoices as we receive them under the modification terms.
Thank you.
Madam Treasurer, are you...
No, as long as the comptroller has all the invoices, I just want to make sure that, in fact, we got them and that we get our money.
Yes, we, our staff does, and we're happy to share them.
No, that's all right.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Could I just get a quick update on vaccines? What's going on in the prisons with staff and inmates, I guess?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question, Mr. Comptroller. So to date, we've held, as a department, for our staff, 25 vaccination clinics all across the regions, from one end of the state to the other. I'm pleased to tell you I attended most, and I had the same privilege of watching people be very thankful for that opportunity. We vaccinated 4,009 staff during our first dose clinics, and 3,222 doses have already been administered, and we're prepared to start our second dose clinics for our staff again, I believe, March 3rd. To date, pursuant to the governor's direction and MDH guidelines, we vaccinated 734 inmates within our system, the 65 and older population pursuant to 1B and 1C have been vaccinated. 84% of those eligible thus far in those priority groups have voluntarily chosen to be vaccinated. So, again, please, with that outreach level and throughout the system, our ability to, I would say, educate not only our staff but also within the inmate population of the importance of vaccination as we emerge from this pandemic in the future.
Thank you. And I don't want anyone to think that obviously the state has a statutory obligation, moral imperative, to ensure the safety and well-being of our correction staff and the inmate population. So I appreciate your efforts, Mr. Secretary, and actions to ensure that. I just want to make sure that this request for audible receipts does not turn into a kind of backroom negotiation to help a company that may have underbid the contract originally and want to recoup some of its losses. That I find completely unacceptable. And I hope that you'll, have oversight on the process as it moves forward.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Comptroller, we will.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Secretary Green, the report that I have this morning, your actual production is slightly higher in terms of the amount of vaccinations that you've done, both first and second. I happen to have it up on my phone, so it's sort of, yeah.
It continues to change.
It's all in terms of how quickly the reports get through. So, good work. Any other questions for the Secretary on this item?
No.
Okay. Item emergency A4, I think we have Secretary Robinson available to answer questions.
Item A4 is an emergency report from the Department of Labor.
Yes, I have a few questions, but I don't want to...
Item A4 and A6,
actually, both of them. A4 is a one-year, $71 million contract to provide emergency adjudication staff resources, and item A6 is an eight-month, $79.8 million modification on a contract with Accenture to increase the total number of temporary virtual call agents. And Secretary Robinson, just a couple of quick questions. First, can you provide us with an overview of Labor's efforts to process unemployment claims, pay benefits, and adjudicate pending cases? Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Tiffany Robinson, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Labor. Thank you, Governor and Mr. Comptroller, for that question. We are thrilled, actually, to have these vendors on board, and I'm happy to provide an update. We did not have the luxury of planning and preparing for a global pandemic that resulted in a more than 800% increase in our claim volume, essentially overnight. The federal funding model, I know I've explained before, funds this program based on resource justification, so that means it's based on workload, which means our staffing was at its lowest capacity in the history of the program pre-pandemic. So I know that you mentioned earlier, Mr. Comptroller, that your office did such a great job to handle 14,000 calls in the first
month. You can't have our employees. No, you can't. We're going to protect them. No, I'm kidding. Madam Secretary, trust me. You know, these are not easy issues, the infrastructure of your agency, et cetera. So,
no. I just make sure it's clear that the reason for these vendors is because we're receiving on average more than 21,000 calls per day. So we have paid almost 18 million weekly payments to almost 800,000 customers. We're really proud of that. We have to redetermine those customers' eligibility through weekly certifications every single week of their claim, and issues can arise every single week, which is why partly why our call volume is high. We now have claimants have 50 weeks of benefits thanks to the Continued Assistance Act, and there's likely to be an extension there. We're happy to say that we have still processed over 95% of all claims. We are deeply committed to assisting unemployed workers in need right now, and you know, to lay out some of the things that we've done to that extent, we've extended call center hours to 7 days a week. We have increased our claim center agents now by over 500%. We've launched a virtual assistant, an interactive voice response system, a live human-to-human chat feature. We've launched the Salesforce customer relationship tool, which is helpful, especially for our legislators. We have established a brand new employer call center specific for employers and third-party agents. We've launched two mobile, and we did all of this while also implementing 9 brand new federal programs under the CARES Act and the Continued Assistance Act that make an entire new group of Marylanders and customers eligible for this program, including the self-employed and independent contractors. We thought we're also dealing with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of fraud. We have blocked 65% of claims coming in since January have been blocked for fraud. And 87% of those claims that are flagged for fraud turn out to actually be fraudulent. So we know what we're doing is important in that regard.
Could you repeat those numbers a little more slowly because they're astounding?
Yes.
They are astounding. Of course, Madam Treasurer, since January alone, January of 2021, 65% of the claims that have been filed have been flagged for fraud. And 87% so far of those claims investigated for fraud have turned out to, in fact, be fraudulent. There is a lot of identity theft happening because of these federal programs. It's not happening only in Maryland. It's happening across the country. Thankfully, in the midst of the pandemic, we also launched a brand new modernized system. We didn't plan to do that during the pandemic, but we're happy we did because it is helping us to detect that fraud in our system on a real-time basis. It also allowed us to be the very first state in the nation to implement the Continued Assistance Act programs to provide the extension relief to our customers without any interruption in benefits to our claimants whatsoever, including that extra $300 that is now available for the additional 11 weeks. So, again,
just a moment. Let me interrupt. Just on that fraud matter and the identity theft, there were claims filed under my name and the governor's name, I think the secretary herself. There are international groups as well as domestic that market this information, you know, this personally identifiable information. Anyone like myself who's worked for the federal government, including retirees of the federal government, because of the breach at OPM a number of years ago, Target, Experian, if you've gotten credit, if you have a Target credit card. So the data is out there. Our personal information is out there, and it's marketed by these different groups. And so when you have this crisis, scamsters and organized crime step in and say, okay, we're going to use these lists or buy this information and see what we can get out of it. And as the Secretary mentioned, some states have been really hit harder in terms of not discovering the scams. as quickly as fortunately we were, as well as the Inspector General at HHS and the U.S. Attorney for her, for Maryland, the outgoing U.S. Attorney for her. So I'll turn it back over to you, but that's been a big issue, and I think the Secretary will mention that 5% that is still out there, that in terms of that are not fraudulent, there's a dispute that is going on, and she can explain that, you know, under our current law, it means for a long process, and that's a challenge. And I know the legislature is looking at that now.
But just for the record, the Lieutenant Governor is not unemployed.
Yeah, correct. But, and they didn't have that correct, but it was flagged, it was caught. I think they realized that, you know, maybe this wasn't the same person.
If the Secretary knows the Chief Deputy Treasurer was also, if her identity was also taken, and I don't know whether it was flagged before she called you, but I don't know whether it was flagged before she called you. There's a lot of fraud out there. There's no
question. But it also shows that it can't be just a mechanical process, you know, to just roll checks out to everyone who's asking.
I have a question. Madam Secretary, I don't want to cut you short. I think if you want to put anything on the record, feel free. I think it's, you know, once again, I'm blaming infrastructure more than anything. But I wanted to I'm particularly troubled by recent reports of Marylanders who, no fault of their own, now are facing overpayment balances, in some cases totaling thousands of dollars. They obviously have no way to repay them, and they're getting billed for, I guess, overpayment of unemployment. And they're allowed to appeal, but it's very disconcerting to people when they get a $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 overpayment demand, and they obviously don't have it. What are we doing in that situation to provide them either with some forbearance or forgiveness, or you know, it may not be true. Maybe like one of these false positive vaccine, false positive tests for COVID, where you get, you know, it's done quickly, and there are quite a few false positives, and you have to get the other tests, but. You know, these are folks that don't understand the system necessarily, and it's when they receive that overpayment demand to pay them back, pay you back, that's pretty chilling. Have you got any handle on the situation?
Thank you. It's a great question, Mr. Comptroller. We are communicating directly with our customers about those overpayments. They are happening for a multitude of reasons, some of which relate to the rules of the federal programs, the PUA for self-employed and independent contractors. When a claimant files, it requires the claimant to estimate their income, and within a couple months' time, they are required to upload documentation to prove that income. Some of those documents come late, and at the time that our staff reviews and reconciles the proof of income versus the estimated income, the claimant may have an overpayment, or we may actually owe them more money, depending on what the proof of income shows, how it reconciles with the estimated income. So we also have complex rules regarding these programs and the reconciliation of whether someone is on one of the federal programs or in a state program. We are constantly searching the system for wages, as I'm sure you know. So if someone does not have wages and is on one of the federal programs, but wages are detected at a later date in our system, they need to be switched back to the regular unemployment insurance program and be paid from the trust fund. Sometimes that triggers an overpayment in one program that then has to be reconciled with the other program. We're trying to communicate better about that directly with our customers so that they know, most importantly, that a notice of overpayment that they receive in their portal is not a bill. It is a notice. We're trying to increase the communication behind that notice and the reasons for it. But they absolutely, if they do not agree that it's correct, they have the opportunity to protest, to communicate with us about, you know, what's going on. There is also the option to seek a waiver for an overpayment. So we're communicating with our customers through direct email about that process as well.
I would just strongly recommend forbearance, forgiveness, some kind of light touch until you verify if someone is complaining. Obviously, there's probably a reason there, at least lack of understanding. So hopefully it's not, if I get something from you saying I'm overpaid, that keeps me up at night, I would think. So be gentle with our constituents. It's not their fault. Putting aside the ones that are, fraudulent, I'm not interested in protecting that.
Sure. That's why we're working to increase our communication. We're also obviously on calls with our my counterparts across the country from other workforce agencies, as well as our federal delegation and U.S. Department of Labor, because, to be quite honest, the federal programs don't allow us to offer forbearance. There is a waiver option that is complex and must go through the appeals process with UI. So we're working with federal partners as well to give us more flexibility in that area.
Okay. I just want to make sure that your department's on schedule to provide the Comptroller's Agency with a list of Relief Act unemployment grant recipients by next week's deadline. That's the first month, I think. And I assume this and subsequent lists also, in addition, will be thoroughly vetted to prevent any fraudulent payments. We're the paymaster, but we're going to rely on you to confirm that there's as little fraud as possible.
Absolutely, sir. My team is analyzing those numbers right now to make sure that the list of customers that we provide to your office is in compliance with the law and excludes every single claim flagged for fraud, because, as I mentioned earlier, those claims are most likely fraudulent, and we certainly don't want our taxpayer funding to go to fraudsters. So we will certainly have that to you by the first date of March 3rd.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Secretary.
Governor, the only thing that I didn't say that I think I want to make sure is loud and clear is that we have paid almost $10 billion in benefits now during this pandemic since March 9th. So, we will keep working hard and make sure every single customer gets the benefits they receive. They're eligible for.
I missed your response to the treasurer, because she claims, and my agency also claims, that they have found fraud in unemployment payments to members of our agencies that you guys apparently did not pick up. So, A, could that possibly be true? And B, are other agencies are you paying attention to vetting all state employees to make sure this is not more widespread?
Yes, sir, we absolutely are. We look at that list every single week of state employees and related high-level officials, in addition to all of the triggers that we have in our system already. We also have a vendor coming on board from a competitive RFP that's going to be helping with fraud in addition to that. I can't tell you specifically which claim was detected by us or by you, Madam Treasurer. So I have to look back to get you an answer to that. We're working with EBM to notify every state agency of anyone on that list every single week. And sometimes, I will be honest with you, sometimes if a fraudster has the correct date of birth, Social Security number, and name, and it gets validated through the Social Security Administration, and it doesn't hit a foreign IP address or any of the other multitude of triggers in our system to connect it, then it will send a notice to the employer, and that's kind of our second, our plan B to catch it, because we do hope to hear from you so that we can block it immediately. And, of course, we're reminding claimants and employers that no one is liable for any benefits that get paid out, that were to get paid out in their name if they are fraudulent.
Well, I know you're working with the chief deputy. I just got a note from her that she actually got a card, UI card, with money on it. And the money was, before she found out what it was about, the money was sent on to another account. It's clearly fraud. And that you're now trying to get the money back, but just to say this is the way Yeah, right.
Right. So in a situation like that, we block the claim immediately, remove the Social Security number from the account, so the file, and work with the bank to recoup. Yeah.
We will not allow her to leave the state treasurer's office. So please know if you see the name on it again.
Okay.
I think that was outlawed by the 13th Amendment, but that's another story. Okay, any other questions on the Secretary's agenda? Observation. Yes.
Just a general for some of these Department of Health, maybe Human Resource, maybe some others. I'm sure there are good reasons. But when there are emergency procurements, I don't believe this is true of you, Madam Secretary, when there are emergency procurements, the procurements are made, everything's proper, I have no question about that, but then they're not reported for 4 months or 5 months. I'm sure in some instances there are truly valid reasons, but in others, they don't get to the light of day. The taxpayers really can't see them until they've been reported. And that's why it's important to keep the reporting up. Just an observation.
Yeah. And that has been raised with a number of our agencies, you know, in the past, is that they need to get these reports out. It's supposed to be 45 days. And so...
Right. And there's a reason for it. It's not just for them to jump through.
Madam Secretary, sometimes I call our 800 number because I keep saying, you know, it's got to be answered within a minute. You ever try your own number?
I sure do. I try that number, and I also try our employer call center number. And we make tweaks regarding those calls every single day. I will go back to mentioning that with over 21,000 calls on average per day, we are not going to be able to always answer every single call. We would need thousands and thousands and thousands of employees. We continue to staff up, and what we've done to combat that is provide all those additional ways to communicate with our office, the virtual chat, the live chat, the Beacon portal chat, the different specific email boxes. We work, you know, around the clock 7 days a week to assist our customers. We'll keep working to improve every single day.
I would never question that. Okay. You know, if you could communicate directly with these people that are getting overpayment notices, I think that would go a long way, or hold off on them temporarily until you get the capability to say to them, hi, we're calling you, we're sending you this, it may be correct, it may not be correct, here's what you need to do, because if I got one, I'd, you know, probably jump out the window.
I doubt you would.
Yeah, maybe not. But, you know,
first floor, maybe.
I mean, I don't know how many there are, Madam Secretary, and it may not be possible, but if there is some way to communicate via email or in the notice itself, et cetera, so that you don't shock people.
Thank you for that. We're working on it.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda? Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Thank you, Governor.
Do we have a motion on Secretary of DPW's agenda? Second. Okay, we're all in favor. Department of Natural Resources.
Hi, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, or almost good afternoon. For the record, I'm Jeannie Hathaway Riccio, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. I want to first thank all three of you for your support of the swallow clause item that was on the Secretary's agenda. And for that, and in addition, we have 8 items on our real property agenda today for which we are seeking approval, and we're happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Madam Secretary, we were out at Swallow Falls approximately a year ago, and there wasn't as much snow out there as there is right now.
That is very true.
But it was still cold. It was still cold out there. Any questions for the Secretary?
Move approval if appropriate.
Okay, I think we have a second. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. University System of Maryland.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Tom Hickey, representing University System of Maryland. We have three items for your consideration, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
I have just a question. I often ask when I see Terrapin development involved on item number two, and I know that the staff here had asked a question in terms of the proceeds for the first parcel in phase one, how that's being distributed. And the answer created another question, because there was an answer that said that the university at College Park, that their ownership percentage would go up from, and I don't remember, I think it was up to 30%, but my understanding before that was that College Park was a 50% owner and the foundation was a 50% owner. So I'm not sure how that changed in this particular case.
I will turn to Ed McGinnis, who is the Assistant Vice President for Real Estate at the University of Maryland College Park, to respond to that.
Okay, thank you.
And good officially afternoon, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. So the very straightforward and easy answer to that question is the ownership interests were never intended to be 50-50. They always intended to be dynamic and to change over time. When we were before this board 2 years ago seeking approval of the contribution agreement to TDC, it was explained that each and every time a University of Maryland property was contributed to the benefit of TDC, that the value of that property would be considered a university investment in the joint venture, and because the investment value went up, the university's ownership percentage would increase. So as time goes on, we're now at the first of the 10 properties in this call agreement. As each one gets, and this is the right word, invested by the university into this enterprise, then the university's percentage ownership and percentage return will increase over time.
Okay. Who is the majority owner?
So as of today, the property that was invested originally by our foundation creates a majority foundation percentage ownership as of today. Again, that will change over time, and was always expected to change over time as this dynamic structure moves forward.
Okay, I guess the key is the dynamic structure. So when the entity was created, was it then 100% owned by 99% owned by the foundation and 1%, or were there other...
No, it was not, because when it was created, even though the university at that time had not contributed real property, the university at that time received credit for what I could generally describe as our previous soft cost contributions to what we have been doing to advance the economic development mission of TDC and the university. So we did receive a credit. I think the numbers were about 80-20. I don't have them specifically. But again, it was always this intention. The good news is each and every time a parcel of property gets invested, that means that there's an opportunity that has come to, again, advance the mission to attract, as in this particular case, private capital to work to advance, again, or just their general mission, if I can describe it as increasing the tax base and creating jobs and just sort of creating or contributing to the sort of, I use the word dynamic, or I'm going to use it again, sort of the dynamic enterprise of making College Park It's the Greater College Park Initiative, so I'll use the word making College Park greater. To be that basic.
No, I appreciate the, you know, the utilitarian, vision, and I think it is good. I just was, a little confused in terms of, that. So, no, I understand it, and it's very good. So, that's the only question I had. I don't have any.
I have a question if you, have time.
Yes, absolutely.
Are the, prepayments that Terrapin Development Company will receive from the recommended tenant one-time or recurring payment?
So those two prepayments that are described in the agenda item are upfront one-time payments. There is a potential for participation rent, sort of to capture, in essence, a windfall in case something, in case we get low, there's a recapture of performance above and beyond the projected pro forma performance. So there is that safety net to capture future home runs, if you will. But what is described in the agenda as upfront payments are, in fact, simply one-time payments.
Got it. What are the total estimated retention rates, parcel B and parcel C, in the base term and the ground lease? I understand, how these rates are determined, I guess, a little bit, but what do you estimate is going to happen?
So it, what we've done, and you can extrapolate it from the numbers that are in the agenda item for the first phase. So that upfront payment is $4.73 million. The projected total net return is $5.04 million. So we're projecting the net present value of that participation rent to be at approximately $350,000. So it is not as projected based upon where we think the rents are going to go, based upon what we think is going to happen in the future. I agree with you, it's not a substantial add-on. But if we're wrong about the future and the rents are greater, then that allows for TDC to participate in, again, what I will call the home run scenario.
Okay. So, Brandywine, we're paying ground rent equal to $15 a square foot. And was that figure, did that have any basis, or was it just, how do we determine it's fair and reasonable?
The part of the reason we determine it's fair and reasonable, again, this was a competitive procurement. There were invitations for many developers to participate. It was two-phased, started with a request for expression of interest. Five parties responded to that. Each of those five parties was invited to participate in the RFP process. Each of those submitted a response. There were multiple factors that were part of the evaluation matrix. Financial was an important part of them, but not the only one. One of them was concept design. One of the things that I'd emphasize, and I think it is a good thing, is we specifically asked this developer to create open spaces, just sort of to create that area for I'm sort of going to read from the RFP right now, that are strategically located to encourage daily active use and interaction on the space. And of those five proposals, Brandywine was at the top of the pile on both the financial return, so that this was not we're taking a low bid here, but they also excelled in adhering to the conceptual design that the TDC and the university thought was appropriate for this sort of main premier corner property. So the response was excellent from a conceptual point of view. It was top of the pile from a financial return point of view. And the other important criteria for Brandywine is they've got a demonstrated track record of working with institutions of higher education. They have, and I mentioned it in the agenda item, So they are engaged sort of at Drexel in the Schuylkill Yards project in Philadelphia, and that's a big project, $3.5 billion. Certainly want to pick a developer that has the ability financially to perform. Brandywine checks that box. I also mentioned one of the things when I was looking at the Schuylkill Yards project that I really liked. It sort of shows where Brandywine is tied to sort of planning visions and conceptual visions. The really first phase that was developed in Schuylkill Yards was a park, Drexel Square. So, you know, their first investment in that, in their first phase, was for this. This is what we want as a look. This is what we want. Just, you know, don't just take your first money-making phase, but start with the conceptual ideas, the vision. Is this, you know, I used the word home run before. We want this project to be a home run from a design perspective, from a usability perspective, from a creating, you know, interaction with the tenants and the users and advancing the university's research mission. And Brandywine checked those boxes.
Right. Well, I also have letters from the mayor of College Park and the Senator Rosenpep and Delegate Justin Pena Melnick and Delegate Ben Barnes all saying the project's terrific. I assume you can keep us informed with any details, for example, about the C parcel or whatever it is. I'd be giving us some information, but keep us in loop. And I'm going to vote for this proposal.
Thank you.
When it comes up for a vote.
A very brief question. I know Brandywine has a good reputation in terms of green buildings and that sort of an environmental concern. Will this development be aimed at the same goal in terms of net zero and other related goals that the university itself is?
So, I think that Brandywine does have a good track record with regards to sustainability. One of the questions we asked in one of the boxes that they checked is, you know, in their substantial portfolio, they're already at close to 7% green energy.
Through offset.
Yeah. So again, mostly through offset. But this project, as it moves forward, and there is a process that's going to move forward. So the next step is to move forward and advance the design to comply with the zoning overlay sector plan that is in place for this area. And the sector plan, this overlay zoning, is very comprehensive. And I got the sustainability section in front of me. I'm not going to worry about reading the whole thing, but I'm going to read the subject headings as to what the planning board is going to look for here. Again, need silver as a minimum, but you've got to go to gold or platinum unless you can show that you can't. Cost of solar and ventilation design are factors. Green materials. On-site energy generation and efficiency, including solar panels. And thoughtful water conservation landscaping. So the process that it is going to go through at the planning board stage is absolutely going to focus on those key issues.
Great. I really thought my question would get a yes or no. Could you get back to me how it matches the university goals in terms of net zero, et cetera?
If it's a yes or no, I think the answer is yes. Again, for the reasons I said, because the process is going to take it to a carbon neutrality perspective. And we're going to steer it that way.
Okay, well, we'll be watching. Thank you.
I hope so. But I hope when we come back, we're going to show you, I'm going to use the word again. You ready? A home run.
Great.
Any other questions from the university agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
Okay. We're all in favor. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Department of Transportation.
Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Greg Slater, Secretary of Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 12 items for your consideration today, and representatives are available to answer any questions.
Okay. I want to get back to the item that was referred last time. That is the contract at MAA. I believe it's item 12.
So we have the one that was deferred from last meeting, as well as a new one on this one. They're all very much related. They're 1 GM and 12 GM. And I also have Executive Director Ricky Smith on here.
Okay. As we talk about 12 GM in particular, I want to have the letters that were brought in the agenda item or 2 weeks ago incorporated with this letters. I don't believe we had any letters that were opposing, but the letters of support I wanted in the record incorporated with this agenda item.
Will do, Governor.
Are there any questions from the members? I know we have some testimony.
Could I suggest we might have some questions after we hear the testimony?
Okay. All right. Now, my listing doesn't say whether people are opposing or supporting, so I'm just going to go down the list that we have. Now, I will state that there, in one instance, there are two people from the same organization, and I'm going to ask for just one of them speak. But let's start with Mr. Robert, and I hope I pronounced your name correctly, Weeks, from Travel Retailer Solution, LLC.
Good morning, board members. How are you today?
Good morning. Did I pronounce your name nearly correct?
Nearly, yeah. it's Weeks, like he waits for the bus.
Okay, Weeks. Sorry about that.
I apologize. My house, I'm sorry, Gray. Our company has been operating out of BWI since 2006. We had originally a coffee shop, Chesapeake Cafe, that closed when the airport did the DE extension, but we currently operate two locations, BGR the Burger Joint and Nature's Kitchen Fresh Cafe. We have lost $200,000 this year, in this past year. Even with the the help that we have already gotten from the airport, we hope to be there for a long time, so we're willing to invest in the business because we like the airport. We've been there forever. We are in support of the motion or the request that MAA is putting forth the way it's written with no other, addendums to it. However, we would like to also say personally, we think this is only a start, that the airport really needs to give more time to make back the money that we've lost. But that's up to you guys. But we need the help. And I can tell you, all of us that are out at the airport, we all speak with each other. We all feel the same way. We've got to have this formalized. We have banks that we answer to for loans. We need to have some stability and certainty when we talk to our bankers. So we ask that you consider it and that you vote positively for approval.
Thank you. We have next Ms. Sherry Cernak. Sherry?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hello, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. My family are the owners of CRC Restaurants, which operates their Brick Inc., and two R&R Seafood bars at BWI Airport. Unfortunately, only a Brick Inc. is currently open because of the COVID crisis and the infected town BWI's business. Our other two places are currently standing vacant. We are at about 50% capacity at the location that is open, so obviously sales are down. Our costs are up due to the COVID protocols, and really everyone in the retail and restaurant business is either closing, basically losing sales, and most of us are in survival mode, not sure of our future. What we're hoping for is a turnaround. At some point, once the vaccines come in and people are traveling again and things are good, we're hoping that we will have that turnaround. Currently, though, we need assistance sooner rather than later, so I'm asking you to please vote for the extension of the MAA contract as it's written. In the short term, suspending the MAG rent and allowing us to do flexible hours will help all of the tenants to accommodate their business but not have to be there when we don't have people traveling. Secondly, extending the lease for Fretport for 1 year minimum and tenants 2 years minimum allows everyone some more time to stage a comeback with business the way that we are used to doing it. In addition, the extension may allow us an opportunity to recoup our losses, rebuild our businesses, employ more people, and perhaps even become profitable. Again, BWI is unique in that there are so many small local family ATDB businesses, not the large corporate chains. That's why it's such a great program. However, that's also why we're vulnerable and need more time to turn things around, and we need it as soon as possible. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Ms. Inez, and I'm definitely going to get this name wrong, Sitabodi? Inez from Arby's Restaurants.
Hello, Mr. Governor, Mr. Controller, Madam Treasurer. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Ines Setiabudi. I'm an ATDB operator. I live in Crofton. We operate Arby's inside AB Food Court and also Gachi House of Sushi, our own brand that we established since 2012 at BWI Pier A and Pier B. So we have three stores. Unfortunately, the Pier A right now is still being shut down since March. Not sure when it's going to open, hopefully soon. We experienced a 60% drop in sales in 2020 compared to the year before pandemic. To be honest with you, I'm hoping that if I have a chance to speak like today, which I appreciate it, I'd like to support if you can give us, I would say, more like a help in lifeline. If you can extend a couple years for all tenants in BWI Airport, if I may say, I'm aware that neighboring airports also offer the same thing, auto extension and also continuous rent relief for all of us. It will help us to definitely taking care of the fixed cost. Unfortunately, the fixed cost is not depending on if a store shut down or not. Fixed costs are for everything from common area maintenance, technology, personal property taxes, equipment leasings, basically all the required maintenance also that we have to do to maintain a good restaurant operation and a healthy operation. Unfortunately, during this time, there are some food cost increase as well and also labor costs that increase. So all these fixed costs, if it's an investment that we put since 2007 with Arby's and 2012 with Gachi. If you are willing to give us extension of 2 or 3 years to all tenants, it will help me to, it will help our company to recoup all the losses and then make the investment reasonable in BWI Airport. At this time, I also like to thank Mr. Governor, Mr. Controller, Madam Treasurer. As ACDPE, in 2020, we received a couple grants from you. So for that, thank you very much. It helped us. I know it didn't help the whole loss of a few hundred thousand that we experienced. But at this time, I also like to thank you all for that. And we are in support of tenant lease year extension. It's a lifeline for all of us. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. You said that you received a state grant. Is that what I deserve?
Yes, of $10,000, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I think Ty will let the governor know. It's the governor who provides those grants. And so
we celebrated the coming of sushi to BWI, as I recall.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes. I'm aware Mr. Controller Peter Frankel has been there before, and he gave us a film.
Oh, is he okay? He's a sushi lover. Good. Very good.
Yeah. Thank you so much again. I know we are busy, but we're ACTB. We're local. I live in Crofton. Long time ago, I had our RV in Annapolis Mall. Apparently, it already closed due to high rent. We have to pay the mall. But I'm thankful to Department of Transportation, MAA, and also Fraport that are willing to talk to somebody at the mall in year 2006 and gave us a chance to bid for the opportunity at BWI. And since then, we expand having two more units in BWI. So for me, who is immigrant to this country, this is like a dream come true. And I like to take care of this dream. Unfortunately, at this time, I really rely on you guys also to help us, you know, to survive the pandemic and make the business prosper again in the future.
Well, thank you, and thank you for, you know, your investment in Maryland and in at the airport. Thank you very much. Sandy Roberts. Mr. Roberts?
Good afternoon, Governor. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Sandy Roberts, and I'm a minority business owner and operator of several retail concepts at PWI, the National Thurgood Marshall Airport. Since 2004. We own at the airport 11 retail operations, several different concepts, including four new stands, a Pinkberry, two NYS sunglasses, and a Charm City operation. We're also in partnership with some larger operators and four other enterprises. Of those enterprises, we have three new stands that are still open, and Charm City and everything else, unfortunately, is closed. Pre-pandemic, we had 72 employees, and we were very proud of being able to grow our business from the operations that we had in 2004 to where we are now. And unfortunately, post-pandemic, we're down to 42 employees, and we're basically struggling, trying to hold on. We want to thank the airport for the MAG relief we were able to receive for the last 11 months or so. Frankly, without that, we don't believe our business or any of the businesses of the concessionaires you heard from earlier would have frankly survived. We think it's important that that MAG relief continue by this extension request, the extension of the MAG relief request, and also the extension of the lease request, which is very, very important. As all the operators here who are individual operators who've made a significant investment into the airport, either through loans or through their personal assets, et cetera, the construction and putting up a facility in the airport is very, very expensive, and it's programmed over the life of the lease and based on the sales that you're anticipating. All of your MAG numbers, all of your percentage rent numbers, all of your CAM numbers, all based on historical numbers that you expect to receive from those businesses. When the pandemic hit, those numbers crashed by, and you've heard numbers, 60%, some cases even higher at the beginning. And so, of course, you know, everyone was struggling. We ourselves have lost close to $500,000 over the past 11 months. And, you know, as I mentioned, without that relief, we would not have been able to survive. I think it's important to have, I know part of the modification before you is to grant the lease retroactively. Of course, we're going to need that that approval, but we're also going to need that relief to go forward a little bit. And so with that, we offer our strong support in favor of the modification as advanced by the administration. In addition, I just want to add two other things for the board's consideration. I know they're not specifically before you, but I think it's important that, you know, by all accounts, what we're hearing in the industry, and we're involved in other airports, so we hear these numbers all the time and talk to industry folk, the traffic at the airport is not expected to return to pre-pandemic levels until approximately 2023. With that in mind, you know, when you think about where we are now, where we see ourselves potentially in the near future, a two-hour modification probably would not be enough. We're probably going to need to hear more. I think you're going to hear that from some of the operators as well. And then the other thing I'd want the board to consider, again, not necessarily in front of you, but it's something that Inez, the person who spoke before me, just said, which is neighboring airports, in addition to the MAG relief and the lease extensions, they have also reduced the percentage rents significantly because those numbers are, again, as I said earlier, based on what the projected numbers were pre-pandemic, and so something for the board to consider. With that, I want to thank the board for giving me the opportunity to be heard. Thank you so much. And with that, if there are any specific questions, I'll take them, but thank you. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. We have Robert GMO from President Silverdine.
Yes, thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you, the whole panel, for the time you're investing. We have been at the airport for close to 15 years, and have seen it from stem to stern, and we applaud the job that MAA has done. We applaud the job that Fraport has done, and we applaud the job that you and the Public Works have done in making this success story that we have been a part of. Notwithstanding that, I'm here to say I am recommending voting no on this proposal, not because directionally it's not the right direction. It's the right direction, but the amount of time frame is insufficient. As I understand the bill, it's 2 years till the end of 2027, whichever comes first. Well, if you have a lease that goes to 2025, then that gets you to 2027, and that works. That gets people 5 years. But if you're like us and a dozen retailers that aren't on this call, but I'll give the names at the end of this, have shorter-term leases, you're in a whole world of hurt. And you're in a world of hurt because if you only get a two-year extension or a three-year extension, the industry full recovery, I think someone just testified earlier, it's going to begin, begin to recover in 13. The projections are 70% in 2023. A full recovery of 100% is not likely till 2024. And no one knows the twists or turns in this pandemic. So what that puts us in a situation is if we have just a 2 or 3 year lease, we have only a one-way ticket to Palookaville because we're riding the train downward, continuing to sustain losses with an uncertain future. And if you have to fund those losses, where do you get the money? Investors, friends, banks, they all say, how do I know you'll have to get the money back? It's really that basic. And no one on this call can say that it's going to come back. The losses are going to reverse themselves magically sooner than the industry recovers. In the industry projection, Wall Street Journal article we submitted, is 70% in 2023 and not fully back till 2014. So I am advocating a small change in the language, which would level the playing field for people with shorter term leases, that says the lesser of 5 year extension or 2027. Just change 2 to 5, and then everyone in the airport has the same time to make it up. Let me illustrate that with some numbers. At Silverdine, we're a larger operator there, and we've worked hard together with the airport to our success. Last year, we paid rent 2019, $1,275,000. I understand from Fraport that that is by far the largest rent. Most of that is percentage rent because we've been able to grow our business. This year, in 2020, we lost $800,000. Now, and we're going to lose over $500,000 next year and something close to that the following year. We simply don't have money in our pocket to pay the rent without being able to take a lease and go to some party, and in our case, the bank, everyone's got a different source of financing, and say, we have a sufficient timeline to both take the losses of the next few years and make them up. And if we don't have a 5-year lease to do that, we can't get the funds, we can't pay our rent. So what's the impact of that on the airport? Well, besides us being a good business, it goes out of business, and besides it's impacting a local leading Maryland restaurant company, because that would have a domino effect on our whole company, which is headquartered in Maryland and one of the larger Maryland restaurant companies. Obviously, we're getting hit in all our locations, so it's not like other people can support this store. We're under threat, and, banks and everyone is saying you have to cut your losses. But beyond that, it's our people. We have 140 employees, some of the better paid jobs with better benefits, and, have tried to be a brand leader for the airport. Those 140 people, which are now down to 75 or 80, are counting on us, and we want to bring them back to 140. But if we can't exist, they can't exist. So you lose jobs, you lose income, you lose a local operator. And this isn't really necessary. Now you might say, why am I raising this alarm? And the other people have spoken in behalf, my brothers here, who all of us, as they say, talk and work together. I think, most people on the call received the letter, and it was well-meaning and said, please support this 2-year extension, or you might not get an extension. This might not happen. So if you're going to drown today or drown tomorrow, you'd rather drown tomorrow. Happy to put that letter in. And I'm not saying that letter was badly intended. I'm sure it was well meant. But, when we spoke to people with shorter-term leases, they didn't have time to get on the phone, to get on the testimony list. People like the two McDonald's, the three NEMs, the Phillips, the Sierra Mesa Kitchen, Market Express, all of which we have emails from. We would love to speak on behalf. So if you want to make businesses survive and get to the other side, I think you need that. You might say, in 2 years we'll give another extension. There are a lot of restaurants already out of business, and they're going to put more out of business with that short-term solution. Where some people are left with 2 or 3 year leases and other people have 5 year or more leases. And I think that's an inequity. So I suggest with a small change, you could level the playing field and win for everyone. And again, I would just close by saying we support Fraport, we support MAA, we support Ricky, we support everyone. But we need first to be able to support ourselves to have the income to get to the other side. We have many other commercial leases. Not one of our dozen locations has a lease less than 5-7 years. Not one landlord has not granted dramatic rent relief where they cut out the mags and just went to percentage. And that's how the banks have financed those locations to make it through. They have turned us down. We've been writing for 9 months. We can't get financing. We can't pay the rent. And we'd like to be a player there, but we can't play without a lease extension. It gives us the funds and the runway to do it. And we shared our financial statements. We opened our books. And we think there's an equitable solution that can be equitable for all parties. And that's why there's a legislative bill that's going to be heard today, because we, you know, the legislator is taking this up of making a 5-year minimum to level the playing field. But I think rather than the legislator of doing this, it should be done by this party book, this group, or at least this group, waiting till the next session to learn more about this inequity and see if there's a way to create a win-win for everyone. I mean, we have MAG relief promised for 6 months. That isn't exactly give a bank or anyone else comfort of what's going to come back, you know, 6 months from now, and 2 years is not enough. So thank you. Sorry to go on. The motion, because we're protecting our people. Our people, we have all, you know, we have 98% minorities in our company who started at the ground up. 7 or 8 people are managers who started as dishwashers. And
thank you. I think you got well beyond the 2 minutes, but thank you very much. Secretary Slater, or I don't know if Executive Director Smith is on the line, but do you want to address some of the concerns you raised?
Absolutely, sir. Let me introduce Executive Director Ricky Smith. He can add some really important context as he was working with a lot of the businesses and his team in really trying to find the relief as quickly as we could for all of our team.
Yes, thank you, Secretary. Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Controller. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. I first want to start out by providing some context so that we're all understanding the landscape that this decision was made in. So back in March of last year, without any warning, without any forecasting, our passenger traffic dropped 96%. That never happened to the airport before, except for 9/11. But the difference is, with 9/11, we knew when traffic was going to come back. With this pandemic, there was no certainty around traffic around when traffic would return. The best forecast, which continues to be the prevailing forecast in the industry, is that we will begin to see pre-pandemic traffic levels sometime around late 23 to early 24. Right? And so the contracts that we're talking about, the subleases to Fraport, they're all based on a minimum annual guarantee, which is separated into a minimum monthly guarantee. And those guarantees are based on a forecasted traffic level under normal conditions. And so we were one of the first airports in the country that took action back in April to provide relief. And so just to add some context to the relief, the purpose of the relief was to rescue these companies that otherwise would die. They would fail. They would close because there was no way that they could continue to provide a guaranteed rent level based on much higher forecast traffic levels. And so we took that action immediately. It was very well welcomed. As a matter of fact, the industry held us out as a model for what other airports should be doing, and other airports followed suit. And so that relief was in place until, in essence, they removed the MAG so that the rent that a subtenant would pay to Fraport would be a percentage of their sales. And so if their sales was $50, they paid a percentage of $50. If it was $10,000, they paid a percentage of $10,000. We thought that was a reasonable approach, and again, it's become a model in the industry. That was intended to provide operating relief to the subtenants so that they can try to survive the best they can throughout this pandemic. In addition to that, we also worked with the Department of Commerce as well as the federal government to make available to them PPP funds. Several of the subtenants received PPP funds. For example, Silver Dino received some $10 million in PPP funds to help support its losses because of its operations at BWI Marshall and some of its other locations. And so those measures were taken to provide relief on an ongoing basis. There are two aspects to the contract. There's the rent that they pay, and then there's the term, the life of the tenancy. This piece only addresses the a one-year extension for Fraport, and that will lead to Fraport providing a two-year extension to the subtenants. We will come back to the Board of Public Works to get approval on those two-year extensions. Now, the significance of the two-year extension, our subtenants make significant investment in their locations whenever they're building out. When they negotiate their tenancy with Fraport, it's based on a number of years. Those years are determined based on what it would take for them to recoup their investment. So if you are a tenant who is 5 years into a seven-year term, then you don't have many more years of recovery necessary because you should have recouped that investment as you've been living the life of that subtenant. So the rationale behind adding 2 years to the end of each existing subtenant is not to renew their arrangement. It is to simply provide them additional time to continue recouping the investment that was built into their existing lease. So a firm that has an expiration in 2025, yes, their lease will be extended to 2027. If your contract expires in 2022, then you will get an extension to 2024. But that's because you should only have 2 years of investment left to recoup. So to give someone with 2 years left of investment to recoup, five additional years is in essence renewing the agreement. And that is not the intent of this piece. This piece is to provide relief. It is to rescue them and to help them wade through this pandemic in a manner that they can survive and stay open and keep people employed and continue to provide services to our tenants. And so you've heard from several of our subtenants, many that are not here, that also appreciate the effort that we put into them. We want to continue to work with Fraport to find many ways to try to provide relief and rescue to our subtenants.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Slater or Mr. Smith?
I want to thank Executive Director and Ricky Smith. He has briefed our staff extensively on this issue and also related issues. I'm not saying that we don't come back for additional relief. I hope the state does, given the situation and some of the testimony from Mr. Giammo and others. I guess I'd just like to ask Director Smith to update the board in 6 months as to where we are with the status of the recovery or the bounce back or recoup or whatever it's called. Because obviously, there are going to be some possibilities, I hope, for the state to continue its support and relief for these small businesses. I also want to ask Mr. Smith to continue to keep the interests of the workers who are at all of these many businesses. These are folks that, if they wish to have some kind of union representation, should have it. And they should be able to, request it without any fear or retaliation or punishment from anybody in a management situation. So that's a side issue that I've discussed with Ricky Smith, and he's, I think, receptive to the fact that, we have to do what's right by the little people as well as obviously the owners of businesses. And I've told everybody all over the state that when SME was given permission to organize the employees of the comptroller's office, all my directors went bananas in opposition and said, don't allow that. And what about the other places, like the governor's office that isn't organized? And, we had to do it because the legislature ordered us to do it. It proved to be a tremendous boon. Now the directors, who were all opposed to it, say, you know what, this really works to have us sit down and communicate with the employees in a way where there's some level playing field. And, you know, I think it was a real eye-opener for our professional staff, and I hope at the airport, ultimately, there will be some form of representation of these, you know, really, I don't say they're low-wage earning employees. They're just in the hospitality sector, which, by definition, I believe would benefit from representation. So thank you very much for letting me, for Mr. Ricky, thank you for the excellent briefing that you've given. It's a complicated issue that's in formation, I would describe it as.
I think Mr. Smith probably can, you know, speak further, but there is union presence amongst the subtenants currently. I believe there are three, maybe four unions that are representing some of the workers in the facility, HMS, I think it is. They have union representation. The seafarers are there, and some other unions. So there is, you know, I guess it's a question of penetration in some of the other subtenants, but there.
Oh, you're right. HMS is
representation.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm just suggesting that it's somewhat in transition, and whenever you have those initiatives underway, there's natural human instinct to say no, hell no, and by the way, I'm going to punish you if you even mention this anymore, and I just don't want to see the workers at the lowest levels have any kind of intimidation or retaliation, obviously that nobody accepts and is not legal, but it gets done behind back doors, and I just want to make sure everyone's alerted that representation is not a negative. It's good in a sense because it, well, we proved it in the Comptroller's
office. Well, and just for your staff who was concerned about representation, comparing it to the governor, you know, our executive departments are represented.
Are they? Great. I thought that they left. I thought they left the treasurer and the governor's office out. Just did it for us.
Office of our executive departments, DGS, is represented by the unions. I've met with them all
just
the time.
Just the governor's office.
Well, we rotate every 4 to 8 years, so. Our folks can't necessarily say, hey, you can't let me go, but it's like every 4 to 8 years, you know, we turn over. So,
well, that's the same argument I made, but they imposed it on me.
So I think it's you and maybe your immediate staff, but those other 900 people that work for you, you know, that's a different story.
And Doug, if I can say just for the record, first of all, you're correct, and I want to thank both the Comptroller and the Treasurer for the meetings that we were able to have with them. I thought they were very fruitful meetings. Your points were well taken, and we will live by those. You may recall me making the point that that no one has a monopoly on caring about the employees at the airport, right? We care about the employees as MAA. We know you care about them. The employers care about them. Our collective bargaining units care about them. And so we just got to make sure that we're all doing everything we can to ensure that the employees at the airport have the best experience as professionals. And we're committed to doing that.
I understand, as we vote on this item, that in the RFP coming up, there will be provisions that we've discussed regarding LPAs.
So we are working with the Attorney General's office and a collective bargaining unit that I will not name in this forum to develop language that will be included in the RFP. Labor code that will be included in the RFP.
Thank you. We rely on you, Ricky. I do have to say I was impressed by the argument about the 5 years versus 2 years. I don't want to vote against this item. I disagree with that. But if there were some way that we could look out, I understand each case differs, but we want to do what we can help do to help all the businesses, small businesses, at the airport, while we recognize this system, which I didn't initially support, of using the intermediary of like Fraport, and we can't get into the negotiations between Fraport and the present tenants, as I understand it, we still have a concern about small business in Maryland. So I hope, Mr. Secretary, Governor, Comptroller, we can all do something together to the extent possible to try to keep people in place, including the concerns that Mr. Gimo indicated may be addressed in legislation.
I'm not sure that legislation is really appropriate, but, you know, because we will always be dragged into contractor subcontract relations, you know, and as a person who used to be running DGS, Secretary Slater, that you're pulled into those items often, and we don't have privity of contract. I know that there was some concern about the mall concept and the way of doing it, but I think no one can doubt that the airport is much better now.
Absolutely.
Customer experience. And you have local small businesses that weren't really there before, you know, that are operators there that was not the case before. And I don't think, I mean, it would be very challenging for, you know, the department itself to try to manage, you know, these, I don't know, how many hundreds of businesses are operating there. So, you know, the concept has worked. I understand the concerns and the challenges of Silver Diner. Everyone in the hospitality industry is struggling because of the pandemic and what's going on. The travel business is, you know, people aren't traveling, and it's going to take some time, as you said, to come back. Now, I know there's some pent-up demand. My wife talks about she just wants to go somewhere, and I think there are a lot of people, but it's still going to be getting them onto the planes and going. I think, like experts are saying, it's going to take some time. So, and Mr. Giano, I hope you've talked to our Commerce Department in terms of any assistance that can be provided. There may be some avenues, the most recent relief act that the legislature passed has some assistance for small businesses that may be able to help, you know, bridge you through this period of time. And, you know, there may be, at least for your off airport facilities, may be some support in our housing community development. The loan programs that they also operate that may be avenues to assist. But if there are any more questions on the transportation agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
Okay. We're all in favor. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. General Services, the Department of General Services.
Good afternoon. The Department of General Services, formerly headed by our own Lieutenant Governor. Good morning. Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I am Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Maryland Department of General Services. Today we are presenting 28 items, including one supplemental for your consideration. We are withdrawing items 6 and 7 and are available to stand for questions at this time.
I'm not going to belabor a whole bunch of stuff because I could talk about, you know, a number of things. I do want to point out PGL4, Sis's Tavern in the town of North Brentwood. I think it was, I don't know if we have Mayor Robinson here.
We have Jacqueline Goodall, the town manager for North Brentwood.
Oh, the town. Okay. Ms. Goodall, are you there?
There we go. I was trying to get there. Good morning, board members, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, and Comptroller Frangela. I haven't seen you in a while since I was mayor there in Forsyth. but I'm here in North Brentwood, and I'm coming on behalf of Mayor Robinson to ask that we be allowed to use the updated appraisal that we received in September, that increased the value to $375,000 from the 2013 appraisal, which was at $72,000. I invite you to come as soon as we get finished. We are in the home stretch. We're much further along than when you saw it, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford. But we do need to be able to use the upgraded, updated appraisal to cover the match in our bond bill. I think it's GO64.
Yeah. You don't need to convince me. I just wanted to point it out because I did see it when it was still just a vacant facility, a reminder of the entertainment establishment that it was many years ago in a different era, and support the vision that the town has for that establishment. So I just wanted to thank you and point that out as a very worthwhile venture and something that will be very good for the town of North Brentwood.
Thank you so much. And it also will be an access to this whole community and the arts district.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and I assume that the increased assessment is good news. I mean,
it is good news, especially when that only showed it when we were 90% complete. And so now we have the electric in, we have the gas in, we're getting ready to finish the floors and finish the interior and move to the design. So when all is said and done, the town will have not only a building that will be an increase to the properties that the town owns, but also a very good example of our restoring our history and keeping our history alive.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary, I just want to thank you. I'm not going to point out all of them, but a number of your contracts are being awarded to certified MBEs or small businesses. Both A&E and construction contracts, and really appreciate seeing that. Can I turn to item 12, IT, the NIC USA contract?
Yes.
There was an extension that was done, and this is, I think, the second extension on the NIC contract. There are a lot of challenges, and I know the treasurer has some concerns about it. A revenue contract. Now, the last time it came before, I know I was sitting on the board, and I had said that I wanted the Office of Procurement to take over the procurement and basically get it done. Now, I envisioned that when I said that we would be coming back with a procurement on the table, that something that would be issued by Maryland and not developing a procurement as a cooperative agreement. It's one thing, and I do support cooperative agreements if they're already out there and they're on the shelf. In this case, they're not already out there. And so the movement has been to work with NASPO, National Association of Procurement Officers, to develop a national cooperative agreement. And there are benefits associated with entering into the national agreement, but they take too darn long. And you're going to have 9 states or more that have to agree on provisions, which would including some of the terms and conditions of a contract. Mm-hmm. They all have to agree on this. And the timeline of 12 to 18 months, which I think is probably short, and then some period of time of transition, then we're looking 2 years away. I am not supportive of that concept. I believe, and if they can't do it, there's a problem, that within the next 6 months, and I say 9 months, that that the state can and should issue a procurement and have it on the street and be evaluating within 9 months. There was already an RFI done, which is great. And there were some 20 or more, I think it was 31, vendors that expressed interest. Now, they may not all express interest in Maryland doing this, but I would think we'd get two or more that would be interested in bidding on ours and waiting for the national group to come up with their cooperative agreement. So I am requesting that the Office of Procurement, you know, if they can do it parallel, they can, but I'm requesting they get a Maryland contract out and on the street and be in the position of evaluating within the next 9 months. And I don't see any reason why that can't happen.
I completely agree with the Lieutenant Governor. With the one addition, I hope that, you can get an audit, which is what the treasurer and
I know, and that's the other issue, and I know the treasurer still has
it. Please, don't forget the audit.
I'll leave that to the treasurer.
Otherwise, I think that's a great suggestion. I'm not sure how to implement
the audit, that is?
No, not the input. I know how to do the audit, and I know how to do the procurement. I'm just not sure how to go from where we are right now to where you articulated for it. I think it's
they can do it. I have trust in the procurement operation. They've already done this RFI, so they pretty much have an idea of what the scope can be. So I would imagine in the next 3 months, they should be able to have a procurement and issue it on the street, and then a period of time after that, maybe 4 months, to get it out on the street. Some period after that to do some evaluation and be in a position to make an award in 6 to 9 months. Because some of the groundwork has already been done, and that's what I was expecting to take place 6 months ago. I thought that now they would be coming back and saying, we need a little more time because we're ready to issue the RFP or we're in the evaluation, one or the other. But they're fiddling around, and I'm just, is that an old term too? Fiddling around with the National Association. And there are benefits to that, but it's when you take the procurement off the shelf that's already out there. You know, if our NIC contract met the requirements that everyone has for audit and we were in a new contract or whatever and it wasn't expiring, then we could be looking at the exercise of putting together a national contract. But it's not there, and Maryland can act quicker. I have faith in our procurement staff. I think the work has already started. They can get it done. Just get it done.
Madam Treasurer, you're the champion of this issue. God bless you and your staff. So whatever you and the Lieutenant Governor...
We just wanted an audit to know why we were paying what we were paying. I've just about given up on that, but I understand people are still planning and working on it. But I would like to hear the Secretary's response to what the Lieutenant Governor said, because there is no doubt that when we last spoke about this, our vision was just as the Lieutenant Governor lays out. What happened and why it shouldn't go that way?
Well, thank you all, of course, for the comments. There are many different issues that we've been trying to resolve over the last time that we discussed the NIC USA contract. In terms of providing a Maryland-centric procurement, of course, Governor, we can go back and look at that. Ultimately, there was the opportunity, and I'll just address the intergovernmental, there was the opportunity to be the lead state on this, and in terms of putting procurement in Maryland, which we are looking, of course, to highlight and expose as one of the leaders in procurement across the United States, that when the opportunity presented itself, we jumped on it. Everything is a matter of resource allocation. This is not a small contract. This is a substantial contract. And when we look back over putting together other contracts of a similar size and importance to the state, they do take some time. But, Governor, I certainly understand you have been in this position as well. You know procurement, and, you know, yes, any and all things can be done. It's just a matter of what resources we really have at hand. And I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole concerning that. We can certainly talk offline.
Let me back up a second, and that is the first part you said, I think, is what got you guys saw stars. You know, stars were in your eyes, an opportunity to, as you said, be a leader. We are not running for the leadership of America's procurement system. We're running for the leadership of Maryland's procurement system, okay? So, you know, others can worry about the national issues and what happens in Washington and what happens across the country. We worry about our small little state of Maryland. This has been an issue for several years now. You know, this is the second of the 6 month. It was supposed to be a year, you know, and we broke it up to 6 months. So, and the governor's been in these meetings between me on these. We need to get this done. And I have faith that you all have the resources to get it done. If it means pulling off of something else, then they pull off of something else. If we need to utilize some of the personnel over at transportation, they have people that can help out, bring them into it, of course, working with the treasurer's office. It needs to get done. It needs to get done now. 9 months is the maximum. Let's get it done. Somebody else used to say that, and I mentioned him earlier. Let's just get it done, and get it done now.
And what about the audit? I'm not going to vote for more extensions unless there's an audit or some proof that there's an audit underway. And, we'll deal with that whenever this comes back to us. I think this is for 6 months, or is it longer? This is a 6 month extension. So
I think this is a 6 month extension.
You know,
I'm supportive of 6 months, that when they come back in 6 months, they address these issues that the treasurer has, as well as be able to report on where they are with the new Maryland procurement. Where are you in 6 months with the new Maryland procurement?
Well, thank you. Yes, we will continue to keep the board advised of where we are, and we can give a periodic update.
And separately, I'd want to update, and, you know, I may be asking your folks to come in or at least call every month on what's going on, because you guys didn't do what we asked you to do. And, you know, I'm not going to diminish the board's authority itself, but I look at it, you didn't do what I asked you to do. Okay, so I go, you know, there's the board and the fact that you guys work for the governor and myself.
Governor, point taken. Falls on my shoulders, and so I'll let that stand.
Okay.
And in terms of the audit, just to go back to respond seriously, yes, to Comptroller, my understanding is that it is going forward. We're doing a past audit.
We're talking about a past audit, and I believe we have briefed the board on that, but I certainly could call the CPO or the deputy CPO on the line, or we can just follow up with you.
We can just follow up. I think we have briefed our staffs, and it is, this past one is going forward. My concern, if we do this right, Mr. Secretary, then all the other states will want to copy us. So you can put yourself, you can put us on the map that way.
Could I just ask the Secretary for a favor on PGS item 20 before we get out of here? It's a very important issue for the city of Cumberland and Allegheny County. Apparently, we're in some kind of land transaction with CSX to make it happen. And Secretary Churchill, I hate to add to your plate of obligations, but if you could somehow resolve the issue so that you get this done, it apparently concerns the Washington Street Bridge.
Yeah, there was a derailment up there in Allegheny County, but CSX appears has been dragging their feet in getting that.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. That's what I was trying to say. Anyway, if something could be resolved there, that would be great. It's been going on for 3 years, I think. I have a network connection. Turn up.
I can hear you. I hear you well.
Okay, great. Oh, okay, I just had a big warning, so I ignored it.
Someone was stealing your identity.
Yeah, probably. Filing unemployment for me.
Right. Okay. All right. We'll look into that as well and see what's going on up there and, you know, why it's taken so long. I don't know I had heard about that from one of the local council members, commission members. That's a concern. So this is really a separate issue and relates to the Howard Street Tunnel and allowing that switch, which has a substantial impact on commerce coming through the port and into the rest of the country. And all those, you know, truckers and port employees that are working. So, okay. Any other questions with regard to... I have a question on 28. I know we're getting late here. 28, it's the option, and that's with conduit.
Yeah. 28, and we do have Webster Yee, Assistant Secretary for Maryland Department of Health, as well as Clean Davis, Acting Director for the Office of Procurement, available to answer questions.
My concern is that this extension goes through the end of May, and so what happens? I mean, are we in the process of, are we on the street with a new procurement? What's going on?
Lieutenant Governor Webster Yee, on behalf of the Maryland Department of Health, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, good afternoon, I guess. To answer your question, sir, there are two contracts on that issue. There is this contract where we have the option for 3 months, runs us through end of May, and then there is a second contract, which is the DDI contract that's currently underway. And so to answer your question, we are in the midst of modifying the second contract to take care of some items that have come up. And we anticipate going back to briefing the board staff. I think the meeting is set for mid-April. So basically, this 3 month extension buys us time to modify the second contract, get things squared away. We understand from conduits that they're working with us. They have a new leadership team, and Secretary Leahy and Trader are working very much closely together with conduit leadership team directly. So the basic point is we're trying to do everything we can to resolve things and move this along.
So you're kind of consolidating into a different contract that you already have in place. That's
yes,
what
it's,
but okay. It's not quite a bid. We'll have to look at what that is. I don't know what that other contract is, whether is it for similar services? You know, is the scope pretty much the same? Maybe I should be asking that separately, but...
Sure, sir. I can give you as much information as you would like.
I would think the board would probably be interested in that because, you know, before you get too far in modifying, there may be some concern that it should be recompeted or a separate procurement. So if you can get some information, I think, to the board before you have that April meeting, let's take a look at that.
Absolutely, sir. We'll give them a full briefing. We've already briefed them about a week ago, and then we'll give them more information as we have it with the second contract, sir.
Okay. All right. Thank you. It's all about competition, right, Mr. Comptroller?
Move approval on that one.
one on the agenda, or just my comment. The approval of my comment. We have a second.
Second.
Okay, general services, thank you. And it is about competition. And even when I started out talking about housing community development and the Bernie grants, even with the nonprofits, we need to have competition. We need to open it up to some of the less sophisticated, you know, in terms of outreach, not to give money away to someone who's not going to be able to perform, but we need to give opportunities to more than just the well-heeled that are already there. So thank you all.
I was very impressed by what you said. I couldn't agree more about it. It's not just a question of being well-heeled. It's knowing the system, knowing where to go. And that's what we've got to really reach out and bring other people in and somehow connect them so that everyone knows the process. And
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't blame people for hiring, you know, consultants and things of that nature. Everyone needs to make a dollar. But, you know, not everyone has that ability to have someone who, you know, already knows the system, and it's something that we, I think, in government should be at least providing more information. And if you decide that you want someone else to write your grant for you or that's fine. But at least have the ability to, because some of these entities that are, you know, revolving around, and not the big guys that I particularly mentioned, but there's some of the others that are getting a little bit smaller, they have been taught the system by somebody. And so in many cases, and I know a couple of them, I'm not going to get into it, they had influence with a local official of some sort, and they learned the process through that local official, helping them through, which was constituent service. That was fine. But there are others who just don't get it. They didn't. I'm not saying they take it to the local official. It's just constituent service, and they learned the system, and others haven't had that ability. So that's the concern I have. So with that, thank you all. And I know we've gone over. It's not a record. So.
We can try again next time.
I think the comptroller doesn't want that, but thank you.
It's okay. Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.